Hello, everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets. And tonight we're talking about September 22nd through the 28th, 1984. Yeah, we're going way back in time. And there's a special reason for this, which we'll get to in a second. But first, I want to introduce the other people on the horn. We got, of course, my co-host as usual, David Bix and Span. Bix, how's it going?
Well, now, although I wasn't actually alive yet for a couple more months when this happened.
You're still too young. And on the other end, we have a first-time guest on this show, but a long-time voice that you've heard on the Place to Be Nation Network, the host of the reaction shows, the host of Goodwill Wrestling, just a jack-of-all-trades.
Good old Will.
Dangerous Alliance podcast. Good old Will from Texas. Will, how's it going?
Christ, man. Even my friends that I've known for 10 years are now calling me good old Will from Texas. What the hell? I'm gonna move to Florida and fuck all of y'all up. You're gonna be like, good old Will from Florida. All right.
Good old Will from Wyoming is on the line.
Oh, I'm never moving there. Fuck that.
So is good old Will from Texas just his new name, like Trevor the Irish wrestling fan?
That's it. Hey, you know what, though? Wyoming is beautiful country, man. I've driven through Wyoming. It's really pretty.
And the reason why I brought up Wyoming is if, we'll get our plugs in later, but the latest exile on Bad Street, talking about Carlos Colon.
I thought you were going to say the Young Pistols.
Talking about Carlos Colon, one was thinking about opening up a territory in Wyoming but instead of going to Puerto Rico. That story is phenomenal. But we'll talk about that later. But anyway, there's a special reason why we're doing 1984 to begin with, and Bix brought this to my attention, and we thought it'd be a pretty good idea. There's a lot of stuff that was going on this week too, but Bix, go ahead and elaborate why we decided to do 1984.
Well, we had been thinking about doing something older anyway for this week, and then like as we were going over it, I was looking at my calendar, and it has the birthdays from Facebook and all that, and I saw that. This past week, it would have been Jim Zordani's birthday, who, some people knew as Clawmaster, and he passed away, God, I guess it was almost 2 years ago now?
Yeah, it's crazy.
And he, was a big AWA fan, I mean, historian about all wrestling, but especially an AWA historian.
One of the most valuable resources for people like me who collect results, he had so much information. He was just, oh man, just phenomenal.
And one of the first guys, if not the first, to really share a lot of his results publicly.
Exactly, yes.
And I was just thinking, hey, maybe just for the heck of it, let's do something that has a big AWA story. So
and boy, do we. As we'll lead off.
Well, it was between two, and I think one of them we were like a week late on, but this one's kind of perfect anyway.
But this one, though, is a bigger deal.
Well, this is a bigger deal than Super Clash, yes.
Yeah, we talked about doing 1985 with Super Clash, but this one, this is a big one because on September 22nd, on the TV show from WTCN Studios in Minneapolis, the AWA announced that Bobby Heenan was suspended from the promotion for life. For no showing all appearances around the horn the previous week, mainly because he had signed with the World Wrestling Federation and made his surprise debut that night at Madison Square Garden in front of 19,000 people, managing Big John Studd as he subbed for an injured Jesse "The Body" Ventura against WWF World Heavyweight Champion Hulk Hogan. Heenan would also make his Minneapolis debut for WWF the next night at the Met Center in front of 7,500 fans, which was main evented by Hogan and Mad Dog Vachon versus George Animal Steel and Big John Studd. Hence why he was suspended on AWA TV. At one point on that show, you had Hogan, Vachon, Heenan, Eddie Sharkey, who just came on as a referee, Gene Okerlund, and Gary DeRusha, who are announcers for AWA, all in the same ring at the same time, which not even a year before, were all part of the AWA roster. Now, this really hurts the AWA and the merchandise department as well, as they had just ordered up a bunch of Weasel Busters shirts with the Ghostbusters logo on the front, but Heenan's face in the middle, which we saw that, with Memphis and the Went Busters for Jimmy Hart.
Right around the same time, actually.
Exactly. Now, the reason
why... Guys, hold on. for those who are not alive yet, like young Mr. Bixenspan.
Yeah.
And Chris will back me up on this. Ghostbusters was fucking huge.
Yeah. Will's everything a little bit older than me.
I know just, that. Jesus.
Will's just
no, a but bit you older know that from reading about it. You didn't experience it, Bix. Yeah, I mean, there are people who yeah, read about no, Thriller.
Ghostbusters no, was still
there
huge.
Are people who read about Thriller and people who lived Thriller. Completely different thing, man.
But Ghostbusters was still pretty huge, though.
Yeah, but it wasn't as big as when it first started. I mean, I was five. And I remember, you know, we had MTV. And I remember that Ray Parker Jr.'s video for Ghostbusters was played nonstop. That song was everywhere. You saw different parodies of it. Hell, like I said, wrestling, I know we had three parodies. Because the Jimmy Hart Mid-South did one with Jim Cornette as well.
What was that one called?
Celebrities, politicians, everybody would like have a Ghostbusters reference that you'd roll your eyes at. It was just like, where's the beef? It was just in your face. Yeah,
exactly. And the deal, and here's the deal about Heenan, though, that I really want to touch on before we talk more about it. You know, a lot revisionist history, a lot of people will say, well, Hulk Hogan leaving the AWA was the death knell. No. This one was way more important than Hulk Hogan leaving, because Bobby Heenan was, you know, no matter who you had in there, whether it was Bot Winkle, Saito, Patera, Lanza, Von Raschke, whoever your lead heels was, Bobby Heenan was the lead heel, no matter what, because he was the manager of the territory and he managed all the heels. And you take away his presence from that promotion, because AWA was still doing strong business, very strong business in 1984 after Hogan left.
Even Mullen 85, they were still pretty
strong. Yeah, but they were still doing 1985. They were doing some really strong houses. Heenan was one of the main reasons for that. You take him away, and now your lead heel manager becomes Sheik Adnan LKC, and it's no contest. And it's just this: the narrative of Hogan leaving as the death knell, like I said, is totally, you know, it was a big blow, but it was nowhere near the end. Now, Will, we did the AWA set. We saw how the AWA was in the first half of the decade, and how it would become the second half of the decade. In your opinion, how important was Bobby Heenan to the promotion?
Oh, man, he was I don't want to say he was as important as Jimmy Hart in Memphis, but he was as important as Jimmy Hart was in Memphis. Because, because, I mean, now Bobby had the benefit of working with one of the best wrestlers of all time, Nick Bockwinkel. That was the unique thing about Bobby, right? He was working with one of the best in the world, whereas Jimmy Hart would work with good wrestlers, but they were either green or they were too old or they were scrubs, and he would get those over, whereas Bobby had the benefit of being there. You know, and similar in the same way in the WWF, where he got to work with the biggest heels, right? He was the guy who managed Andre. Big John Studd was a pretty big deal in 1984. You know, King Kong Bundy main evented WrestleMania 2, largely, I would argue, on the strength of Bobby Heenan being his manager, right? The big thing about WrestleMania 2 was not that King Kong Bundy was a monster. It was, well, if Hogan beats Bundy, you know, Hogan's going to get his hands on Heenan. And so Heenan was huge, man. I mean, and I think when you take people like Jimmy Hart out of Memphis, you take Bobby Heenan out of AWA, I'm sure there are other examples, but, you know, those are the ones that come to me most clearly. Maybe take Freebirds out of Texas, things like that. You just lose a little bit of the heart of the promotion, you know, like, or the guts. You know what I mean? Like, you just lose something like that intangible thing that makes that promotion special in that specific moment in time. And I think that's where the real damage comes, is because who's going to replace Bobby Heenan? Nobody. Who's going to replace Jimmy Hart? Nobody could, and they tried for years. Who's going to replace Junkyard Dog in Mid-South? Nobody. You know, it's really hard to do in this situation. And so, like, I'd agree with you. I think they're lucky in that they still had people like the Road Warriors, Crusher Blackwell there, but their days were numbered too.
And the thing about the Road Warriors, they had just come in, and they were getting hot as an act, and your favorite wrestler, Bruiser Brody, was around doing an angle with Jerry Blackwell, which was really big at that time period before Brody, you know, did his usual bullshit and no show and all that crap. But, Yeah, I mean, it was gigantic blow. And at this time, Heenan was doing angles with the Fabs. It was Heenan and Saito against the Fabulous Ones. And they were doing the matches around the horn. And when Heenan left, the Fabs were pretty much dead in the water, too, as far as their standing in AWA. And they would be back in Memphis a couple months later. Now, Bix, you know, the deal with, you know, we talk about Vachon and, you know, Gene Okerlund going over to, you know, two important guys. Gary DeRusha was an important guy too in this whole deal. And Eddie Sharkey. Talk about the roles that DeRusha and Sharkey play.
Well, now I always try to remember, Gary was the father or the son?
Gary was the father.
So Gary was in charge of their production and all that? Or was it just Al that, I always forget which is...
No, Al was the father. Gary was the son. But yeah, Al... Yeah.
Gary, the one they hired was the one for production.
Yes.
So, and they rated, I think he wasn't the only person they rated in production, right? There were a few, right?
Yeah.
So, they took away AWA's production staff, which, at the time, I guess, functionally wasn't a huge deal because they did such a simple production, but still, I mean, it's still a big deal. And then, who was the other one you said?
Eddie Sharkey.
Oh, Eddie Sharkey. Now, had Eddie Sharkey ever been working in the AWA at this point?
He wasn't like their de facto trainer, but he was like the go-to guy.
But he had his complicated history with Vern.
Yeah, and this was done to try to lure the Road Warriors in because Eddie Sharkey was their trainer.
Right. But I mean, I would think it wouldn't be that difficult to lure Eddie Sharkey away from the AWA. What was it that besides that they were just in opposition with various promoter BS, like, what was it that Vern slept with Sharkey's wife or whatever it was?
That was a rumor. What? I don't know how true that was. But
and
that was
Sharkey
a rumor.
Shot up Vern's office?
Yes. Now, Vern's office did get shot up.
Okay, so pro wrestling. They were working together and then they weren't.
Old man Vern was laying the pipe, wasn't he?
Who was his wife again?
Oh, God.
It was a wrestler, right? She was a wrestler.
Oh, man, I can't remember who she was.
Wasn't also part of the irony to this that she was, if not black, then a person of color, given Vern's various...
Hey, if Chris doesn't know...
...with pushing wrestlers.
Princess Little Cloud.
Okay.
Oh, shit, I was going to say, if Chris doesn't know, I feel bad that I have idea what y'all are talking about.
She was a fake Indian.
Okay. Well, she's a fake Native American. She could be any race in pro wrestling.
Yeah.
So, anyway, you know what fascinates me about the Heenan thing, and I don't think I realized this until, you know, looking at the notes and the newsletters and stuff. Of all the people, and this is something I was always talking about over the years, Heenan was the one guy who actually gave his notice to Vern.
Yes.
So not only did, I mean, I knew Vern was kind of ungrateful with that, but I didn't realize that that's also then the one guy who Vern's like, well, we're suspending him because he no-showed his dates. the guys to do that to.
Yeah, that's right. He's the only one that gave the notice. And, I mean, Vern just took that seriously, I guess, because I guess he knew, like, we knew how important Heenan was to the product. Now, another thing we mentioned, you know, we'll talk about WWF later, but Jesse Ventura's injury, Vix, elaborate on that whole situation.
Blood clots in his lungs, which I think at times he's tried to, I don't know how seriously, tried to tie with serving in Vietnam and...
Hey, dude, that was the first thing
Agent
that came
Orange
to my mind was Agent
stuff.
Orange, yeah.
Although, I mean, I don't think he actually ever saw combat in Vietnam. I think most of his time was in the Philippines and stuff, but whatever the reason was, I mean, he absolutely had blood clots in his lungs and he ended up having to retire over it. I think he took like a year and a half off and then came back and then didn't last because he worked a little bit in 86, right?
He was around 85, late 85 okay. Wrestling.
Okay, so it was late 85, but yeah, so he came back after about a year, and he just wasn't, it was just like he had no stamina, right? That type of thing?
Yeah.
And now when did he start doing the announcing? Was it right after this then? When
yeah.
he was healthy again?
Yeah, he replaced,
Mosca. Yes, because Angelo Mosca, on All-Star Wrestling, because Angelo Mosca was quitting as an announcer to make more time for training his son, the great Angelo Mosca Jr.,
yes.
Oh, Christ.
The legendary wrestler.
Yeah, and then Jesse took over as co-host for All-Star Wrestling with Jack Reynolds, and then when Primetime started in January, I think.
Yeah.
It was Reynolds and Jesse, and then it was Gorilla and Jesse, and then before, and then finally it was Gorilla and Heenan. And, you know, Jesse, I actually wanted to bring this up, you know, his, in contrast to Heenan, he probably gave Vern the biggest FU of anyone, right?
Oh, totally.
Because he, I love this story. He agrees to start with Vince, but first there's a promo day at the studio for AWA, and he cuts like 6 weeks worth of promos. He had already sent a telegram to Vern, though, giving his notice, and it arrived the next day, and Vern just used all the promos, even though Jesse started like the next day with Vince or something, and because Vern was not afraid to advertise guys who weren't going to be there.
Another thing I want to mention before we move on real quick.
All right.
Yeah. Well, you can expand on your point in a minute, but one thing I really want to mention real quick about the attendance for the WWF show at the Met Center was
that's how it's low for that.
Yeah, they drew 7,500, and then the month before was their debut, when that was the one with Hogan and Gene Okerlund.
No. The debut was June with Hogan and Dave Schultz.
That's right. Yeah, it's August. Okay. You're right.
And August was the return. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hogan and Gene against Fuji and Steel. And that drew over 13,000. So they lost almost half the crowd, and with Mad Dog Vachon in the main event. So, yeah, that's all interesting little dynamic there.
Well,
how important Gene was.
There were no comedy trading vignettes for Mad Dog.
Exactly. Now, Will, you were going to say something?
I was just going to talk about like the hubris of these wrestling promoters back then. You know, like it almost feels like Jerry Jarrett is the only one who kind of knew when to dial back. You know what I mean? Like the idea that you lose these guys, or that you treat someone like Heenan, who actually gave his notice, like shit, but like, you know, you just, you're tone deaf to what's going around you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I guess exactly. No, you don't.
Yeah. You hear me?
Yeah, they were all living in their own world.
Yeah. I think we may have lost Will.
I'm here.
No. Okay. But anyway, yeah, definitely. And all the promoters didn't know how to act, especially guys like Ole Anderson and Bill Watts.
Oh, really?
Bill Watts. You know, guys like that, they had their personalities, Vern Gagne, they had this huge alpha male personality that they couldn't take the fact that their talent was going to work somewhere else like that. You know, this wasn't like, you know, the old days, you know, when you're trading talent, whatever, it was different. Now we got a totally different deal. You know, 1984 was the beginning of the burial videos, and I always want to started it, you know, showing his guys beating WWF guys. Then Watts took it over. And, you know, of course, Vern had his little deals. The interesting guy in all this was Fritz. Fritz was playing Switzerland here. Hmm. Yeah, he was playing both sides of the fence. And it was talked about. I don't have it in the notes. Yeah, I don't. But there was scuttlebutt going on at the time that you know, Vince really thought he had world class in his pocket. And in fact, at a press conference in Japan or a couple weeks before this week, he had pretty much gone out and said that World Class was an affiliate of WWF. And, you know, talking about how the Von Erichs would be soon working big shows in Madison Square Garden and all this other stuff. He thought he had them. And,
well, the thing with Fritz, the thing Fritz had the benefit of was his top baby faces were his kids.
Exactly.
So he never had to worry about his kids leaving.
So Fritz saw, you know, basically, like I said, was playing Switzerland, playing neutral. And eventually, of course, he, you know, sided with NWA. But, yeah, I mean, it was just a weird time in the business to watch how these promoters were acting, because they were getting raided, quote unquote, for the first time in, you know, a long time. And, yeah, I mean, Vern was a special case because Vince was really after him. he really had a hard on for Vern because he wanted to buy.
Well, I think he wanted Chicago. I think that was his goal.
Well, he wanted to buy AWA. I mean, that's a known story that he, you know.
No, I know, but I mean, like, Chicago was right there, and that's Vern's yard. And so I think he really wanted to expand to Chicago first, you know, because that's the second hub to take over.
Yeah, yeah, it was a big deal.
Did he have Los Angeles yet?
Yes, he started running Los Angeles with Mike LaBelle as local promoter in 83.
So he had Los Angeles in 83, well before the expansion started.
Okay, so think about that. He already has New York and L.A., the two biggest markets. Now he wants the third one. That's why he went after Vern so hard.
Yeah, because Vern took over Chicago in 83 after Bob Lewis retired. And AWA started running exclusive AWA shows there. Because before, Chicago was Bob Luce, and you had a mixture of AWA and Bruiser's talent there working. And now in 83, you start having all Vern talent. So who was
Bruiser's talent in 83?
Spike Huber, Steve Regal, Bobo Brazil.
Wait, he said talent. Well, why the hell are you putting Steve Regal in that conversation?
I knew that would get a rise out of you. But yeah, that's the guys that were WWA. Jackie Ruffin.
Who?
Tom Lynch. Of course, it was Tom Lynch. It was a hodgepodge of talent. But yeah, Bruiser's days were well past gone. But yeah, Will's got a great point about Chicago. And he wanted those TV markets. Like Minneapolis is a big market. Chicago.
Milwaukee.
San Francisco. You know, can't forget them in this because they're a huge market as well. And, it's just Vince, like I said, had a hard on for Vern. And speaking of invasions, we talk about All Japan Pro Wrestling. And they had a big deal going on where Naoki Otsuka, who joined All Japan weeks earlier as a local promoter in Tokyo, came to terms with Riki Choshu, Yoshiaki Yatsu, Anima Hamaguchi, Osamu Teranishi, Kuniaki Kobayashi, Killer Khan, at Masa Saito to work for him as a liaison with All Japan Pro Wrestling. This happened on September 22nd. Osuka's promotion will be called Japan Pro Wrestling, and he said that he plans on poaching Haruka Aigen and Shuji Kazuki from New Japan as well before it's all said and done. No word on when the Japan Pro guys will be working All Japan Television because they are still contractually obligated to New Japan until January. But there's a precedent there, as both Yoshiaki Fujiwara and Nobuhiko Takada were free to leave as long as they pay back their bonuses and other money advanced to them. Now, Otsuka was New Japan's local promoter in Tokyo for years before he had a big falling out with Inoki and started work with Baba. And in fact, his first show with Baba was August 25th show. And I can't remember all the matches on that show, but it was one of the big Tokyo shows of the year. And it wasn't at Sumo Hall.
But hey, how did Saito work out in All Japan, man?
No, man. I mean, Burger King killed his Japanese career for a couple of years.
That had already happened by then. I mean, he just hadn't had the trial yet.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
yeah, and Khan and Saito were based out of America. You know, of course, Khan was working for World Class. So they were coming in, you know, like Gaijin would come in. So, yeah. I mean, this is a big deal for New Japan and All Japan because 1984, you're seeing a lot of changes going on business-wise because Sayama had left the year earlier. He and Inoki had been forced out with a coup d'etat and brought back.
UWF guys.
UWF starts up, like with Mitchell Fujiwara and Takato. You know, Maeda.
And originally is more of a direct New Japan competitor.
Yeah, they were directly competing with New Japan. Because Hisashi Shima, former New Japan president, was the boss of UWF.
No one remembers that, too, that it was originally just pretty much a New Japan-style promotion.
Yeah, but that didn't last very long, though.
No.
Like, a couple of tours in, they completely changed up. But All Japan, you look at this time, they were going through some problems as well. And to have these guys coming in, who were the hottest act in the country, although they wouldn't be able to start working directly until January. Huge deal, Will. Huge deal. We watched All Japan Television for the Death Valley Drive 80 set. Those guys come into the promotion, that was a huge shot in the arm.
Oh yeah, hell yeah! It was a it almost coincided with All Japan becoming exciting and New Japan becoming woefully dull until the New Japan versus UWF feud.
Exactly, because you look at the dynamic here. All Japan never went with like the natives versus natives concept. I mean, they had matches and they would have, you know, things here and there.
Title matches.
Not as their main angle. And you add this on top of the Gaijin they were bringing in, like Brody and Hansen. And, well, Brody was gone not too long after this, but Hansen, Terry Gordy, Ted DiBiase, you know, all these guys like that. You add those to these guys, and you have all these fresh matchups involving Jumbo and Tenryu. And this feud really made Tenryu. I mean, it really made him into a big star. I mean, it was huge for business, huge for in the ring. I mean, it was a total win for All Japan, Bix. I mean, there's no other way around it. They did the right move.
Oh yeah. Now, quick question though: the guys who were coming back from Calgary, which were Shinji Takano, Hiro Saito, and Junji Harada, when did they sign with All Japan? Because Calgary had just closed up, so I would have thought they already would have been back in Japan.
They weren't. They didn't come until later on.
Okay. So was that not till 85 then? When when did? Because Harada was because Harada was
Harada
in
was
Japan,
soft,
already went
machine.
Back in Japan. Right. That's right. He didn't come until after he was.
Yeah, and then he became a strong machine.
And then Hiro Saito was working Cobra in junior heavyweight title matches in 85.
Okay, so they came in later. That's right.
Yeah, they were the second wave.
But they did join Ishin Gundam.
They became the Calgary Hurricanes.
But that became part of Ishin Gundam, didn't it?
Eventually, yeah, but they weren't at first.
I'm trying to think
I'll tell you what, though. What this really did for All Japan is it really changed. I think this is the genesis of when you saw the All Japan stop being a DQ count-out company. This is when you started seeing guys getting pinned on a regular basis. And, you know, to kind of kickstart that amazing run of, like, top flight matches for the next decade.
That's a great point, and I've never seen anyone make it before, because everyone always credits the UWF popularity in, you know, 88, 89. But, I mean, you're right. When you think about those big Ishin Gundam matches, most of them do have clean finishes.
Yeah, and then by 87, 88, you know, even Bruiser Brody was taking falls on TV right before he died.
I mean, they still had big non-finishes, though, like the first Jumbo Tenryu match or the second or both.
Well, think about that, though. They had non-finishes in the first Jumbo Tenryu match in a series that culminates with one of the greatest matches of all time, which was a very decisive finish.
And it was a good non-finish, too. I mean, it was, because if I remember correctly, the first match is the one where Jumbo is just beating the hell out of Tenryu in the corner and gets DQ'd, right?
Right. But, you know, unless it was a title change, I mean, prior to that, it was all double DQs, double countouts. Let's celebrate because this guy beat the other guy in the ring. I mean, and that stuff got tiring because that was across all territories, right? I mean,
well, and it was so lazy the way they do it in All Japan, though. It would just be, okay, let's tumble out of the ring to do the double countout.
Right. And sometimes it would work well. I mean, it'd be entertaining, but yeah, man.
The clear winner in this whole deal was Yoshiaki Otsu. I mean, he became a guy who was, you know, fourth in command, pretty much, in Ishin Gundam. And, of course, with Saito's problems, Hamaguchi getting older and retiring, Yotsu became Choshu's main tag partner and had some of the classic matches of the decade against Jumbo and Tenryu. And, of course, when Choshu and crew jumped back, Yotsu stayed. Yep. He stayed on with All Japan and, of course, went on the team with Jumbo and formed another one, the great tag team.
One of the best.
So Yotsu is loyal to All Japan now because of the way they treated him, the way he was treated there.
Well, so, until Tenryu starts up a promotion, but yeah.
And then Kuniaki Kobayashi, you know, goes on and becomes the main rival for Tiger Mask 2, Misawa. You know, and they have some really great matches.
You know, I gotta be honest, as great as the Yotsu and Choshu against Jumbo and Tenryu matches are, I think my personal favorite match, though, is still the the very first one with the Saito.
I can understand why you would think that because of the uniqueness and like the first time.
There's the heat and also just the I like what Saito brings to that match too.
Yeah, yeah, but, yeah. Being second to Saito is no insult, you know.
But
Saito's a pretty great fucking wrestler.
Those tag matches, though, the Yatsu Choshu tag matches are some of the best matches of the decade.
Now, when did I'm trying to think. So, who else ended up coming in? Because I'm trying to think as far as like younger guys or whatever. Norio Hanaga eventually came in.
Well, Hase and Nakura were Japan Pro guys,
right?
Kisuke Sasaki was originally a Japan Pro guy, but went to New Japan.
And people don't remember that Sasaki made his pro debut in All Japan too.
He made his pro debut in All Japan. And this also led to eventually guys like Shiro Koshinaka leaving going to New Japan.
What year did he go? When exactly did Koshinaka leave?
It was not too long after this or around this time. So, I mean, there's some that go to New Japan because of it. But, yeah, I mean, it's a big deal. Like I said, it freshens up that scene so much because, God, you know, Will, you could attest to this. You know, we saw so many matches between Baba, Jumbo Tenryu versus Hanson, Brody, etc. You know, it got to be kind of samey, and now you got this and this whole new element, man. It just exploded.
Oh yeah. I mean, they're doing hour long draws with Choshu, which may be hit or miss, but they're still doing it. You know, they're doing the tag matches, they're doing the bloody wars, like with the Killer Khan, who did Killer Khan fight in the bloody
Choshu after they broke up?
Choshu match. I mean, so now not only do you have like Ishin Gundam versus the All Japan guys, you have Ishin Gundam versus Ishin Gundam members, you know?
Yeah.
Plus the All Japan versus All Japan guys. Plus, you know, I mean, just, man, end of 84, early 85, man, this territory is about to explode. And I can't wait to be on like another edition a year from now when we talk about like full blown Ishin Gundam in All Japan sometime.
And they picked up the British Bulldogs a couple months later, too.
And the Road Warriors debuted in 85. So, I mean, it's just so much going on. On the other side of the coin, we had New Japan Pro Wrestling, where lots of uncertainty is flying around as all the Ishin Gundam guys have left. And it was also announced this week that Osamu Kido would be joining UWF on October the 5th. Antonio Inoki's financial problems, which mounted even more with the $500,000 payoff to the WWF for rights to booking their talent for tours, has everyone questioning what is going to happen next. The only top natives on the roster right now are Inoki, Seiji Sakaguchi, Kataro Hoshino, Tatsumi Fujinami, Kengo Kimura, and the newly created Super Strong Machines, Junji Harada and Ricky Bossin. And, of course, they had the young lions like Muto, Chono, and Hashimoto as well. But, you know, they were opening match guys then.
But when did the third and fourth Strong Machine come in?
Later on. Okay. And then you had, you know, some of the other juniors. But that was the main heavyweight natives. We mentioned about WWF earlier. That was the press conference where Vince talked about world class. Hogan was there. And all this other stuff. And the thing about Hogan, I mean, Hogan was supposed to work 2 weeks for New Japan right before this. But WWF's house show promoter, whatever, the guy that did the lineups, forgot about it and had already booked Hogan on house shows for WWF. So he had a no-show New Japan. This is like right around the time that New Japan's paying $500,000 out to get these rights. And this is a big deal in Japan because they're thinking that Inoki's putting these Americans over his native talent. You know, he wants that America to feel so bad. He's promised bookings in Madison Square Garden, which, of course, he got, you know, in December against Dr. D, and he won that battle royal. It's all Inoki vanity play here. And, Will, that was a problem for years in New Japan to come, is Inoki putting himself over the good of the promotion.
I think you're right in one sense. But when he wanted to, Inoki could go. You know, it wasn't like old Inoki who, you know, just pops up and, you know, is in tag matches. He could go. But I kind of like the dynamic. I mean, WWF wrestlers, you know, kind of breathe a fresh breath of air into the promotion. For me, you know, watching Inoki and Hogan, watching Who else came in? Greg Valentine came in.
Adonis Murdoch.
Adonis Murdoch, obviously, one of Phil Schneider's most hated tag teams. I love them. Chris, you watched that footage with me. They were pretty great.
Yeah, they were.
You know, so I liked it. Plus, I mean, guys like Yamada, before he became Liger, I mean, he's working the undercard, and he's having great matches. Don Arakawa, he's having great matches. So New Japan's not dead in the water. New Japan benefits that even when Ishin Gundan left, they were so deep, you know, whereas, you know, in natives, that when, you know, a lot of the natives left, they still, oh, really? They still have Fujinami, who's one of the best in the world? You know, well, Sakaguchi was a serviceable tag team partner.
But where WWF screwed them, though, was they would send guys like Iron Mike Sharp, and Samu came over.
Right.
Brian Blair.
King Kong Bundy, before he was in WWF, actually was in New Japan. But
did Vince book him into New Japan, though?
I think that coincided, yes. But they didn't get all the top talent for WWF, of course, because WWF wanted the guys over here. I mean, Hogan would come in and out, but... and Andre, that was probably the main reason. Hogan and Andre, keeping them around. Yeah. You know, that was the main reason why the deal was done. But it's funny how we have now the shift where all Japan's doing, going to start doing natives versus natives. And now New Japan's having to rely on
the Gaijin.
Natives versus Gaijin and the Strong Machines. Strong Machines got a huge push.
And they weren't very good, man.
And at this time, they were wearing the football pads and it was a corny gimmick, but you know, it kind of got over in a way, but it wasn't until, and like it or not, Will, it wasn't until Brody got there that, you know, in 85 that New Japan got a spark. And of course he screwed up and eventually left. But, yeah, they had some issues until UWF came back at the end of 85, you know,
okay.
85 I'll was a down year. 85 was a down year in New Japan. It really was. That spark in when UWF came in is what helped them get back where they was at. But, Bix, you look at, you know, Osamu Kido and Fujiwara and Takada going to UWF. I think that those guys leaving may be just as important as Ishin Gundan guys leaving.
Yeah, I mean, Fujiwara, I mean, he was never pushed that big at that
Ever.
Point. No, really. I mean, not. I mean, he really wasn't pushed much at all until he was older, and even then he wasn't used as a top guy. I mean, Kido was sometimes kind of slotted in on top, and Takada was one of their best prospects, too. That I feel like, was probably the biggest blow in terms of who they would have actually used in a top position.
What about, I mean, because, I mean, I know Tiger Mask had already left New Japan, but what about, like, Sayama actually joining UWF? Like, doesn't that feel like a kick in the nuts?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
And the reason why I think that it was maybe not as important, but just close enough, is, you know, sure, Ishin Gundan had that was your main, you know, rivals of your native army, your regular army. But taking out Fujiwara, Takada, Maeda, Kido, Yamazaki, all those guys that did leave, that's like taking your meat out of your second rung.
Well,
and now, you know, it's a big blow to having, you know, these younger guys gone.
Well, especially
right below Inoki.
Well, especially Maeda, because Maeda was already starting to work on top.
Exactly.
I mean, Yamazaki and Takada were more like rising star mid-carder types, but, like, I mean, Takada, that's kind of an interesting what-if for me, if Takada had stuck around, because that match with the Atsu, of all people we were just talking about, is so good. But it's so different because it's not, because everything else we've ever seen with Takada is post, at least, the first UWF.
So all UWF style.
Right. Or the, you know, UWF influenced version of New Japan style. And I'm kind of curious to see what he would have done as a more straight up New Japan style guy, because he's so good in that match. So I think he was a pretty big loss. I mean, you know, he became a huge star, and, you know, rightfully so. He was a great worker, you know, handsome guy, all that, charismatic. Wasn't he one of the guys that had a rep in Japan as being a good promo, too?
Yes.
I mean, he was just a total package of a, you know, wrestling star. So I think that hurt. I mean, it didn't hurt in the immediately because he wasn't pushed yet, but I don't think Maeda leaving is talked about enough the first time. Because he was a big part of the original Ishin-Gundan versus Psychogun feud.
Yeah.
And
they were putting him over in singles matches against Gaijin too, like Paul Orndorff.
Yeah, I mean, and then he left. I mean, that was a bigger deal, I think, than most people talk about it as being usually.
Now, the $500,000 deal with Vince, that basically fell apart in June of 85. Your opinion?
Although that was, I think, a second payment, because wasn't there another payment closer to WrestleMania? Another $500,000?
Yes. So really a million. Was it worth it in your eyes to do that deal?
I mean, what else would they have had during 85, though?
Well, that's what, I mean.
They could have probably, go.
Of course, that with Brody coming in, you know. So maybe you're spending money on Brody, you're spending money on WWF. I mean, there's way too much money going out to foreigners.
Yes.
I would argue. Oh, sorry, Bix. I was just going to say, I would argue that you could take that money and make smaller deals with other promotions.
Well, there aren't really... You mean American promotions?
Yeah.
Well, they would eventually. You know, they eventually would work with Mid-South and World Class and stuff like that later on.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. They could have done it here while those territories were still up and running and hot.
Well, also, it's because it feels like more of a star power thing, because really, most of the guys, it's not like they were booking guys who were really that compatible with New Japan style. Like, I feel like if they booked someone from, there are other guys they could have booked that probably would have fit better.
Well, another thing is all Japan had all the NWA ties. So you look at, you know, who is left that's not NWA. Mid-South was not NWA. All, you know, they were booking Flair and stuff. Were friendly, but they were not NWA.
But I think Watts would have creamed to have like an evil Japanese team. I
mean, Memphis, of course, worked with New Japan often, but worked with All Japan too.
But they never booked guys out of. I mean, they sent guys to plenty. See, I mean, they had relationships with basically every office.
Yeah, and Lawler would work All Japan in January '85 too,
and then would work New Japan in '88.
When did Inoki stop being a member of the NWA? When he made the deal with Vince?
Because
he was on the board in 83.
They were always members of NWA. But
no, not always.
Well, a lot of the time they were.
For the 80s, at least at the beginning of the 80s, they were.
Yeah.
Well, let's just establish this. At least in 83, Chris, the summer of 83, Inoki was on the board.
It probably coincided with WWF then.
Okay.
So when WWF left, then they left. Because, you know, Hishima was the president of WWF. You know, the figurehead role.
Right.
So, and that was until Jack Tunney took over in the summer of 84.
I just think for the money, I think Inoki could have talked Vince down to $200,000 and Vince would have been real happy.
Well, how about that money, though?
How about AWA? You know, try to hook up with Vern.
But Vern's with Baba.
Well, that's true. And that's another strange thing. Vern's with Baba, yet Baba's working with NWA too. So you got Flair and Martel both there at the same time as champions. You know, having Martel.
Yeah, but that's not unlike Paul Bosch did the same shit.
Yeah, and that's just one town though. This is competing in the in the same country against other promotions.
Yeah, but isn't Japan like really just one big mega city?
And you know Vern would have put that money in a heartbeat. Yeah, you are right in that regard. You know Vern would have put that money in a heartbeat. He would have loved to have that money. I don't know. It's just it's all interesting.
Could you imagine Brad Reinagans and Steve Regal?
Well, Brad Reinagans would become a New Japan. Hey, he became a New Japan guy.
I know, but no, it was my Steve Regal setup. Sorry. You know, Steve Jimmy Regal Garvin versus Seiki Sakaguchi. All right. And
Jimmy Garvin had just done a tour of All Japan right before this week we're talking about. So, yeah, I mean, those guys were going over.
Nice long.
yeah, those guys are going over there. But woo, Japan at this time, you know, after a really hot early part of the decade, this year, 84, was interesting in a lot of ways. All right, now we'll go to Mexico. And this wasn't covered in the newsletters at this time period. Dave really didn't have a lot of Mexico coverage until a couple years later. But the big Anniversario show took place, the 51st, at Arena Mexico on the 21st. Now, technically, it doesn't fall in our time period, but Mexico City is an hour behind us. I'm sure the main event didn't go on until midnight on the 22nd, so we're putting it in here, damn it. All right, and there's a couple of big matches on this show too that we need to talk about. First, we had a mass versus mass match, and Atlantis, who just beat La Sombra for his mask 9 days ago at the Anniversario show at Arena Mexico, the 82nd one.
A year ago took
Ultimo Guerrero's mask. This is his first. He defeats Talisman. And his first big mask match, Talisman and Mask, is Arturo Beristain, who would remask years later as Io de Gladiador. And which, you know, that's always interesting to me that these guys, they lose their mask and then remask again. Because you're not supposed to do that, but whatever. But the main event of this show was a rematch of the year earlier, which was probably the greatest match of the decade in Mexico. Maybe the greatest match of the decade in the world, and that's Sangre Chicana over Emma's Uno in the Hair versus Mask match. And now this year we have the Hair versus Hair match, which Chicana wins that one. Now this is an interesting match where he it's not as bloody and as violent as the year before, but it's a damn great match. Chicana wins by count out. Because he KO'd MS1 on a dive to the floor, and he couldn't make it back to the ring. So, a huge deal there. And, I mean, Will, we did the Lucha set for the 80s project. You know, we talked about this just about everything now, the 80s project, age project, for the Death Valley Driver. The Chicana MS1 feud, I mean, those two matches, God, I mean, that first match especially, I mean, it just doesn't get any better.
Well, the second match is like merely a top 10 match or top 20 contender for Lucha in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
Whereas the 83 match is a contender for best match of all time. So there's no fault in just being merely a great match. And the thing that really stands out is one, MS1 is such a great, like, traditional snobby heel. Like, he doesn't do anything that would make you want to cheer for him. Am I wrong in that?
Yeah, he's like Gino Hernandez.
Yes. You know, especially with like that bleach blonde hair. I don't know. Did he have bleach blonde hair in this match?
And I want to correct myself. He didn't lose his match the year before. He had lost it to the Rayo de Jalisco in 82. It was another hair match. So they did hair versus hair 2 years in a row. But go ahead.
Yeah. That's why when we were looking over notes for this, I was like, oh man, greatest match of all time. Oh shit, that happened the year before. But, you know, and then Sangre Chicana is a guy who I consider a minimalist, right? Right, Chris? He's not a guy who does a bunch of flips and high flying moves. You know, he's a guy who's going to punch you in the face. He's a guy who's going to bloody you up, bite your forehead. He's going to tear at your skin. You know, he's going to beat you to a bloody pulp. That's Sangre Chicana to me, one of the best punchers of all time. And for these guys to get together, it's almost you think of matches, and I wish we had like two or three more matches from this. I think we had this. I think we have a tag or a trios match with them against each other.
Yeah, the week before. Yeah.
Right. And we have the greatest of all time contender. But I really wish we had like – kind of a long series, kind of the way we have like with Santo and Casas or Flair and Steamboat, so people could truly appreciate, or, you know, Kawada Misawa, so people could truly appreciate the greatness of these two guys going against each other, you know, because it really is a top flight feud. Bix, do you disagree with any of that?
Hello? Hey.
Yes.
I said, oh, sorry. I was unmuting my mic. I didn't catch it, I guess. No.
I do it all the time.
No, I do not disagree.
Talk about the punches. We'll talk about the punches. The punches in these matches are just, I mean, it's like all-time style punches. And especially, you know, the first match had the one where Sangre Chicana's mother was at ringside as well, and she was just a wreck. I mean, it's just, you don't get a lot of that in Lucha anymore. Luckily, we've got it these past couple of years with the drama and the mass matches, but it's something you don't see in wrestling no more, that drama.
No, I agree, man, because like I said, it's not about the moves. It's about I don't want to call it a chess match. That sounds too cliche, but it's about which guy can outlast the other. That's what it's about. It's a war. It's okay. You won the first fall, like in the super match, you know, MS1 wins the first fall by bum rush and Chicana. This one is set up a little slightly different, a little less hate filled, but it's still okay. You won the first fall, but all it takes is an instant, one instant, for things to turn around and for me to capitalize to get the second fall. So it really does build and build and build to where you don't care what moves they're doing on each other. It's which guy can survive the other guy.
Yeah, and like you said, this one, you know, it's a rematch. They work this more as a, you know, competitive style match.
Right.
It was more worked as a title match in a way. There wasn't a lot of blood. But
not in this one. Yeah. But in this one, it was a little bit more subdued. But you got to think, MS1 had already had his hair taken by this man a year before. So yeah. He's got to come in a little bit more humble. You know what I mean? In the sense that got to take it a little bit more seriously. I would argue that he should have been a little bit more violent, a little bit more hate-filled, a little bit more angrier. But, you know, that's just me.
Now, Biggs, Atlantis has become the premier big match wrestler of these recent years in Mexico and across the world. I mean, retaining his mask 2 straight years in matches where it was questionable whether he would keep it or not. And this is his first one. And Atlantis was only into his second full year as a competitor. He has become, you know, I guess you would call the king of the mask matches right now.
At least in the context of the anniversary shows, I mean, over a longer period of time, and then recently, yeah, I mean, you keep up with more indie lucha than me. I mean, these days, like, how much even on smaller shows are there major mask matches relative to the size of the show?
I mean, they happen, but it's not the same.
And it's usually scrubs that lose their matches.
Yeah.
It's not legends.
Yeah, and you look at Atlantis, all right, these are the guys that he took their mask, all right? Talisman was the first. He took Hombre Bala's mask. He took Tierra Venta y Fuego's mask. Kung Fu. The Animals, Eddie Watson, Chuck Walton. Mano Negra, Ray Parada, Viano Testero, which is the all-timer. Silver Fox, El Barriqua, which is Herodes. A fake Grand Marcus, El Padrino, Ultimo Guerrero, and La Sombra. I mean, there's some big names there that he's taken the hoods off of. And he's, like I said, he's become the big man, you know, in Mexico lately.
And the last two anniversary shows plus the Viano 3, like, all-time classic moments.
Exactly. And this is the first one of those runs. What's sad, though, about this time, and we can talk about this, is the lack of footage that we have of Mexico in the 80s is just
depressing.
It's criminal.
So where did they have TV in the States? Was it just Univision, or did Galavision exist on a small level?
I think Univision at start, and then Galavision later on.
Yeah, do you know when Galavision started in the States?
I can't remember. 89?
So that's when they actually launched, because I know that's when mostly where we have tapes starting with.
Yeah. And a lot of this stuff aired outside of Mexico City.
Maybe as early as late 88, Chris.
Okay. Well, Mexico City, you know, didn't have it. So only your television would be regional, and that's where these matches would be shown.
But hold on. You got to think, since the Lutheroth family has owned this company for, what, 122 years?
Yeah.
Okay. that they have a huge collection of this stuff, right?
Oh, Televisa definitely has a lot of tape.
You know, sure. because they are you know, kind of looking for new revenue streams. Do you ever think that they could ever launch like a network style internet program the way Japan World or NWA Classics? Like, isn't that kind of like the holy grail of new stations that we're looking for?
Well, you would think so. I mean, and they have proven to be more computer literate than you would think from with people in charge, because now they're, I mean, they're live streaming shows every Monday night at Pueblos, streamed on their YouTube channel.
And they're not screwing up like AAA, right?
Yeah, and their Friday shows are streaming on Collateral Sports.
Well, they did screw up the paywall.
But they but that, you know.
No, but their streams are always pretty much flawless.
And the thing is that they don't have a great TV in Mexico right now. So this is the way of getting their shows out there is online. So, yeah, it would make sense to do an online service. Totally.
Oh, man, have that classic matches section.
Oh, yeah. And,
I mean, dude, just releasing all of the Aniversarios on tape
would be amazing. Complete.
And then you'd have us nerds from America, man, just eating that up, trying to find a way to convert our dollars to pesos, man.
Well, I mean, it was easy to order the iPay-per-views from people that told me that when they ordered it. It was you know, they worked with the same people that Tharp works with for NWA Classics.
Are you guys kind of pissed off that we did a reaction show on the Triple Mania and not the Aniversario show?
Well, the one thing about the Aniversario show was, though, that it was the same night as the Ring of Honor pay-per-view. So y'all, I mean, you guys wouldn't have been there. You were in San Antonio. Yeah,
I know, but...
It would have been an interesting show. But, yeah, I mean, it makes sense for them to try to do something now. Yeah,
I have to wait till our good friend Alfredo gets it on a DVD, and I'll have to pick up his DVDs.
Does Televisa have full ownership of the footage, or do the Luteros own parts?
I would think Televisa has it.
Okay.
And, of course, they haven't been on Televisa in a while since they got, canceled from the network.
I just think that would be something that they'd want to have to exploit.
Well, you'd think Televisa would do it. But, I mean, who knows what the people in charge think over there and the networks and all this other stuff. It's just a different environment.
What we need to do is find someone who speaks Spanish like Alfredo.
Yeah.
We need to get the data on the network and the data on the New Japan World, more New Japan World than anything.
Yeah.
And find out if there's any success in it, you know, to kind of pitch this. So we need to take a trip to Mexico City, get our finest Men's Warehouse suits out, okay, go meet with the executives of Televisa.
Well, Rob Bahar is there now. We ought to dispatch him over there with use some of his Canadian charm.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Well, I guess they could just insult Americans all day long.
How long is he keeping his trip this year?
He's coming back, I think, tomorrow. Well, as far as we're taping, I think he's coming back today. The day this show drops.
So he basically did like a 2-week trip this time.
Yes. Okay. And on that note, we're going to take a quick break and let the place the B-Boys pay the bills. And when we come back to America.
Oh, hold on, Chris. Since we're talking about Lucha, I know I'm fucking up your outro.
Yeah.
Check it out. At the ROH show, since we mentioned it, I met a buddy, Eduardo, from the board, and his real name is Eduardo, I think. And we were talking, and he recently said that in his town in the valley here in South Texas, that Parada Morgan is doing matches where he just beats the shit out of young guys. So I just wanted to throw that in there, that if you're ever in South Texas, watch Parada Morgan beat the shit out of young luchadors.
Yeah, they have a lot of shows there, and he's on there. And yeah, so that's a thriving little scene down there, one little indie scene. So yeah, if you're in South Texas, go check them out. But again, we're going to take the quick break and get these ads out there. And when we come back, we're going to come back to America and talk about one of the best brawls ever on Memphis television. And that says a lot. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly.
Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past through Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network. That's the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, Wrestling Culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Goodwill Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's tag teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWOPTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
And we're back, and listen to all those shows that you just heard about, especially mine, and whatever shows Will's on to. So,
listen to all our shows. When I wasn't on the show with Barriqua.
Listen to all our shows. Well, you're a guest tonight, so I'm going to plug your shows tonight.
Well, for now on, I'm going to have Barriqua on as my co-host for the reaction shows. Me and Barriqua doing reaction.
You know what? We should actually make it clear, since we mentioned earlier, this Barriqua is not Erodis.
And it's not it's not Fidel Sierra
or who was the last El Barriqua
for Del Barriqua, Rush's father.
It's not
was
big
that
fun.
The one that was in the that was in the Los Barriqua staple?
Yeah, that's Rush's father. Yeah, Poder Barriqua.
Oh, Poder Barriqua. Yes. I like that guy.
For hip hop fans, it's not Big Pun. I'm not a crusher.
It's not Big Pun. Yeah, exactly.
Not a player. I just crush a lot.
That's right. And yeah, definitely. And speaking of places where that have a huge Puerto Rican fan base, let's go to Memphis.
Where we have
some great, great television on September 22nd. As Lance Russell brings out Jerry Jarrett on the show, and they talked about the Pro Wrestling USA tapings that occurred on September 18th, which we'll talk about that in a minute. And Jerry Jarrett is presented a trophy for being a great promoter by the other promoters, which is great, and for putting that show together.
None of the other promoters are there.
Yeah, none of the other promoters are there. He just has a trophy. So, of course, Jimmy Hart, King Kong Bundy, and Rick Rude show up, and they whine about not being on the taping, saying that they're big stars, blah, blah, blah. And they start to rough up
Jarrett.
Weren't
on the tapings.
Yeah, they weren't on the tapings.
They should be glad.
But, yeah, they should be. And they start to rough up Jarrett, which brings out Jerry Lawler and the newly turned babyface, Macho Man Randy Savage, and they have one of the best brawls ever in the Memphis studios. Bix, I know you just freshly watched this before the show. This was a really insane brawl.
Yeah, it's not like guys chasing each other around the studio as much as some of the other memorable studio brawls are, as much as it's like just grimy guys just like jumping and pounding onto each other, like right at the announcer's desk. And Lawler using like what looks like a steel wastebasket and just chucking it at everyone. Jimmy Hart getting involved. Lance cheering on Savage and telling him to hit Jimmy Hart again. Just utter craziness.
Yeah, Lance was awesome in this segment, by the way. Just so awesome. And being Lance Russell. I mean, nobody could do it better than Lance. But Will, I mean, we did the, again, another theme here. We did this on the Memphis 80 set. And Randy Savage is a babyface. Like I said, just had turned before. I mean, he got red hot real quick as Lawler's tag partner. And Rude and Bundy were really great adversaries for them.
Well, here's what I like about this segment, okay? Because when Rude and Bundy come out, they're in their wrestling gear, you know? And Jimmy Hart's in, like, his Elvis jumpsuit, you know, even though it's, you know, mid-80s, whatever. You know, he's Jimmy Hart, do whatever he wants. But Randy Savage comes out in a black T-shirt, in jeans, which I've never seen up maybe until, what, NWO era, if he did it in the NWO era. Jerry Lawler's in jeans and a T-shirt. Half of the brawl, or like in a polo shirt, half the brawl, Jerry Lawler's shirt is rolled up to where like his midsection's exposed. And it's a brawl. It's not bloody brawl. It's not like Tommy Rich and Eddie Gilbert busting each other up and the blood flowing. But it is maybe the most realistic brawl. It's like four guys who legitimately hate each other. When they hit each other, I mean, all of them are throwing just like haymakers and like nasty punches. And the Bix, you remember this, the studio wall comes tumbling down. Yeah. You know, Lance Russell's desk is flipped over. Chris mentioned the trash can. Jimmy Hart is well in a way. It's not like he's playing the comedy character. It's like he's really trying to beat the shit out of somebody.
You know what Hart reminds me of in that brawl?
What's that?
He's like someone's crazed girlfriend trying to help him in a fight.
Yeah, no, that's a perfect way. But they're all crazed. I mean, and dude, I used to work nightclubs. And, you know, one of the you know, pre-MMA era, because I don't even know, like, how bouncers handle drunks now, you know, in this. Because now you never know who can kick your ass, right? Could be that 120-pound guy, you know, who can choke you out. Who knows? But back in the day, one of the ways – bouncers would take guys down was that front face lock. You know, you put them in a front face lock, put the leverage on them and take them down. You know, one of ways kind of not, don't hurt a guy, but you subdue a guy, especially a drunk. And they do that a lot here. I mean, it just felt really realistic, you know, with the way they were fighting. It really felt like a situation got out of control and four guys that legitimately hate each other are going at it. That's what it felt like to me. Like if you and your best friend got jumped by the bullies and you were fighting for your lives.
And see, the deal with Lawler and Rude is Lawler and Rude had then already had this heated angle. You know, the whole deal where Rick Rude bashed Jerry Lawler's car has already happened. I mean, Lawler and Rude are having this huge feud. And then you throw in Bundy and Savage into the mix. Like I said, Savage had just turned face. And I mean,
they already done the Bundy Lawler $10,000 body slam challenge?
Yes, they've already done that. So, I mean, it's just insanity. And Savage, the babyface, was still Randy Savage. you know, at this time period. He was still out of control, Randy Savage.
It's like how Bigelow would be a couple years later.
Yeah. Right.
Well, that's a good point, because I want to ask you this, Bix, because, I mean, Chris, there's probably no bigger three Memphis fans in life than us three, right? Besides guys who actually lived through the stuff, you know? But I'm saying, like, in our neck of the woods, our little place in the internet world, like, and Bix, I mean, I came late to the party. You know, you were one of the first guys that promoted Memphis to me, like, you know, and I thank you for that. You, Phil Schneider, Chris. But, you know, now, you know, Memphis wrestling is my favorite wrestling of all time. You know, nothing else comes close. That's why when we're doing this greatest wrestling ever project over a pro wrestling only, and people are like, well, how can you have Jerry Lawler over Ric Flair? Ric Flair is a great wrestler. He's in my top 10. You know, El Santo, Casas, Kawada, Tenryu, Jumbo, they're all in my top 10, you know, but they're not my favorite type of wrestling of all time. Memphis wrestling is my favorite wrestling. So if the best wrestler in your favorite type of wrestling is a guy who's had a long career, great matches throughout the career, match of the years, great feuds, whatever, why wouldn't you put him at number one? So Jerry Lawler's my number one. But I think the great thing about this, and Rick Rude went on to have some peaks, like 1992 WCW was a peak for Rick Rude, right? Being able to carry Ultimate Warrior to good matches was a peak for Rick Rude. Being part of the R&R with Manny Fernandez was kind of a peak. But for as green as Rude was here, this is a peak in Rude's career. And there's, I'd probably say it, man, this is probably the peak in Bundy's career in ring. Because in WWF, there's nothing in ring that carries it. Had some memorable stuff in Texas, and that's about it. But this is by far the peak in ring for Bundy and Rude. And as a tag team, they just fit together. They naturally fit together. It feels right. It feels like the right tag team. And just Savage and Lawler felt like a good tag team. And I love that about Lawler. He can always grab a former enemy and make him a partner and make it seem like that guy's the most logical guy to be his partner. And that's something we talked about on a previous episode of Exile, Chris.
Yeah, and it's credible because Lawler, you know, it's kind of like we talk about with Carlos Colon. That Carlos Colon had to go to Abdullah the Butcher a couple of times to be his partner in occasion. Lawler wouldn't have to go to guys like Savage and Austin Idol and whoever to be his partner.
Dundee, Dutch.
You know, whenever he needed them. Eddie Gilbert.
Andy Kaufman.
And whenever he needed somebody to fight this war with
him. Now, to be fair, Andy Kaufman swindled Lawler and asked Lawler to be his partner.
Yes, right. Yes,
but Phil Hickerson.
I mean, Lawler has a track record. He'll be of working with his enemies to fight for the common good. But yeah, I mean, you're totally right on this. I mean, this is a very hot period of Memphis.
And those matches those two teams had too.
Yeah, they had
amazing
singles matches. Savage and Rude had a really good singles match there. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going, and it didn't last long because Rude would turn face for a very short time before turning on Lawler. Yeah, turning on Lawler and then went to Florida. So this feud only lasted maybe a few weeks, but it was mega hot. And this brawl is just amazing. It's on YouTube, go look it up.
If you just search for those
– Memphis. Yeah. Oh, go.
Yeah, just type in Rude, Bundy, Lawler, Savage.
Yeah, all you got to do is type in Lawler, Bundy, Rude.
Yeah.
Because I know, because just to make sure I didn't screw anything up, I did that a few minutes ago. But anyway, I mean, that's besides the point.
But yeah,
it's on 70s TV's channel.
But yeah. back to Memphis, right? Isn't that kind of like the genius of Memphis is that they can have amazing brawls, amazing angles in the studio, classic moments, classic matches. And as long as you have guys like Lawler and Dundee as kind of your mainstays, or Dutch or Tommy Rich or Eddie Gilbert, the show just keeps rolling. And they did it for years and years. I mean, the 70s Memphis is awesome. 80s is like the pinnacle of Memphis wrestling. The 90s, they were still putting on classic angles and really great matches when we could grab a hold of them. You know, I mean, there's very few arena matches from Memphis in that time period. But when they did, they usually delivered. So, I mean, I can't say enough about this. I'm glad we talked about this week because I tend to remember things like the Eddie Gilbert, Tommy Rich breakup angle, or, you know, something like the Moondogs and Lawler Jarrett. But, man, seeing something like this, which is so realistic, so intense, man, you can understand why Memphis was so hot for so long and kind of outlasted all the other territories. They just did TV right.
And this is one of the great finds on that set because I don't remember people talking about this brawl before we talked about it on the set. You know, there really wasn't a lot, you know, talk about. I mean, yeah, some people talk about Lawler and Rude, the car angle is always remembered, and Savage turning. But like this in particular, I never heard anybody really talk about before. So, yeah, it's a great revelation. Now, also on that same television show, we have more Memphis royalty as Dutch Mantell and Tommy Rich are supposed to defend their Southern tag titles against the Nightmares. But Tommy Rich no shows. Hey, it happens. So Dutch has to go it alone and face the Nightmares in a handicap match. Well, Dutch is having issues with Eddie Gilbert anyway as a side feud. So Eddie joins in, and Eddie and the Nightmares just beat the shit out of Dutch as TV time runs out because they can't beat him. They beat him up, but Dutch still just he won't go down. So Dutch and Tommy are still the champions, although it wouldn't be for long. So, you know, you had this going on, and Eddie put his hair up against Dutch. The next night, on a Sunday night show at the Cook Convention Center in Memphis, he put his hair up against Dutch's International Heavyweight title. Eddie wins the title, his first big singles belt in Memphis, and now we're starting to see the emergence of Eddie Gilbert. And Eddie Gilbert would become one of the best heels of the decade, and this is the genesis of that run.
Right. And, you know, the thing about Eddie Gilbert is Eddie Gilbert's involved in some of the best angles of all time, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
No doubt. Mm-hmm. But I always wanted more from him in the ring. Not saying he never delivered, but I always wanted more. But, you know, it's kind of like Lawler, you know, didn't always have the classic matches, but he would build up to the classic matches, whereas Eddie Gilbert would build up a feud, but you never quite got like that all-time classic to pay off the feud. But as one of the heels, as a mouthpiece, as a guy who can make things go in the studio, as a guy who can make you believe him when he's turning face or whatever, all-time classic. But I love this breakup of Wildfire Tommy Rich and Dutch Mantell, man. You know, I think it's one of the most amazing things. It's just another exhibit in why Memphis is my favorite wrestling.
And why Tommy Rich is leaving is he's going back to work for Georgia.
Right.
So this is the way of getting him out of there.
Yeah, writing him out.
But Bix, Eddie Gilbert in 1984 was not Eddie Gilbert in 1988. Talk about the early Eddie Gilbert heel, you know, how he was compared to how he would become.
I mean, this is very early in Tim as a heel because the tag team of the year angle was about a month and a half earlier, right?
Yes, right.
And yep. He had turned heel, what, a week or two before that?
Yeah.
So he's only been a heel for about a couple months.
Yeah.
And he's not as refined as a promo, for sure. Although he does have that great performance in the tag team of the year angle, but when you watch like his regular heel promos, he's still a little nervous, he's still a little off, and he doesn't have the whole like hot stuff persona together yet, is what I would say. But he's still really good. I mean, he's and he can shine in those big moments. But I'd say he figured out what he wanted to be when he was in Mid-South.
Yeah, with the Watts stuff, no doubt.
And you could see early on, though, in 85, though, before he left Memphis.
Oh, yeah,
when he became General Eddie Gilbert, that, you know, he was starting to find himself there. And I think a lot of things had to do with Gilbert was, you know, at this time period in the First Family, he's, you know, at best third behind Rude and Bundy.
And had he actually joined the First Family yet?
He was affiliated, yes.
Okay.
And so when they leave, he gets bumped up to the top spot, and he takes the ball and he runs with it.
Yeah. So, and he also had the misfortune, though, of being tied into the whole Jimmy Hart leaving thing. And I think,
yeah,
I think that kind of shines a bad light on that first feud with Lawler.
Yeah.
Because even though you have the great stuff like him ripping off the general, you know, General Jerry thing and then doing the This Is Your Life. I mean, you have him running around with Tommy H pretending, you know, to be Jimmy Hart and that all the, it's kind of weird, but I starts to turn things around doing This Is Your Life, which is a classic Memphis segment, and then he gets the offer from, you know, Mid-South because he wants to, we talked about this last week, that Jared had promised him that when Tom Renesto was done that he'd get the book, but he wasn't doing great money-wise, and Ricky Morton was able to get him a job in Mid-South, and he did what he had to do.
And the rest is history. And, yeah, it's just an interesting time in Memphis.
I'm still going to give him props, though, in the sense that here's a guy who's still pretty green. And you know, for his first heel run, by 6 months into his heel run, he's a classic heel.
Yeah, he became awesome, no doubt. And on to another promotion, though, that's going in a different direction is Championship Wrestling from Florida.
That direction would be down.
Downward, because, of course, Dusty has left about a month or so earlier to go to work for Jim Crockett as the booker. And they're having issues of their own.
I don't think you actually said the word Florida.
What?
I think you forgot to actually say Florida.
No, he said Championship Wrestling.
Championship from Florida.
I'm fading out. I'm sorry.
So anyway.
Fucking Bix.
I know, man. They're having problems because WWF's now trying to invade. And they're invading Miami. They're not going for Tampa. They're going for Miami, which, of course, is the bigger market. And on September 22nd, we have head-to-head competition. As CWF's running their usual spot, the Miami Beach Auditorium and Convention Hall. And WWF's running the bigger James L. Knight Center. Now, here's your cards for the evening. We have, from CWF, we have Colonel Buckley, Christopher George Robley III, Buck Robley, going over Shotgun Willie.
Who the hell is Shotgun Willie?
Beats the shit out of me. Then we have One Man Gang going over The Saint, then followed up with One Man Gang going over Sir Oliver Humperdinck. I guess it's one of those deals where you beat the guy, you get 5 minutes with a manager.
And The Saint, of course, was Dave Sierra.
Dave Sierra. Although there were conflicting reports on this show that it was Ted DiBiase.
What?
Yes. So I doubt that was right. But yeah, I had seen before where he was listed as being the Saint on this card, which made no sense. So that's why I didn't say it at first. Scott McGee over Dick Slater. Then we have this match, which is interesting in this time period. The Rock and Roll Express over Ivan and Nikita Koloff.
Yeah, I had no idea this happened.
In CWF teams. In 1984.
From two different territories meeting in another territory.
Well, Rock and Roll Express this time was on their Lose or Leave Town deal with Mid-South.
So they were in Memphis.
They were just about to go back. They did a tour of Florida and then went back on October 1st. And Ivan Nikita down here, I guess, mainly because Dusty.
Probably to get Nikita trained. The guy has to be greener than fucking grass.
Yeah, but they were very few shots in Florida. So this is one of those rare things.
But I'm saying, though, Nikita, is he even a personality on TV yet?
In
84?
Yeah, he started in 84.
Yeah, this is not too long after he started. So then we have the Southern Heavyweight title, where Pistol Pez Watley goes over Kevin Sullivan to win the belt. Then we have Jesse Barr and Dory Funk Jr. battling Billy Jack and Mike Graham to a DDQ. And that your
fucking make me barf.
And then you had your main event, Ric Flair defend the World Heavyweight title over Dusty Rhodes by countout. Now, WWF that same night, I don't have an attendance for the CWF show. But WWF drew 2,000 at their show at the James L. Knight Center, which is a terrible number. Now, here's probably the reasons why. Here's your card. The Moondogs over Rusty Brooks and Aldo Marino, who would become Ricky Santana. Then we have Iron Sheik going over Joe Mascara. We have Wendy Richter defending her women's title over the fabulous Moolah.
Oh, God.
Then we have Bob.
Yes, the great, fabulous Moolah.
I didn't mean great though.
The great Moolah. No, it's the great Moolah. Her face painted heel gimmick.
Yeah.
So hold on. Before we continue, so Wendy Richter had been champion before WrestleMania.
Yes.
Yes. At Brawl Central, she won on MTV. She won on MTV in July or August.
July.
July 84.
Okay, yeah. Okay. I thought it was later than that, but okay.
No, no. She went on the Garden Show after the Sarge Sheik boot camp match.
Got it, got it.
And then we have Bob Orton Jr. over Joe Murto, Michael Hayes over Rene Goulet, which we'll talk about the Freebirds later on, Junkyard Dog over George Animal Steel, Tito defending his Intercontinental title over Paul Orndorff, and Andre the Giant over Roddy Piper by countout. Now, here's what's interesting about this. The issue of there was an issue, though, as the Miami Herald on the day after September 23rd printed that Dusty had defeated Ric Flair to win the NWA World Heavyweight title when that wasn't the case. And there was talk that the WWF called in the wrong results to the newspaper as a prank. And the newspaper had to go back and retract their story. Now,
I don't even see the point of that.
I guess
just to fuck with them.
I guess to say that they did a fake title change or something like that to try to screw the fans over, you know, something like that. I don't know. Will, do you believe that they did that? Do you think that they had a hand in doing that on purpose?
As petty as Vince is, I wouldn't put it past somebody in that company. But at the same time, I don't know, because at that time back then, you typically didn't even acknowledge the other companies, right?
Yeah.
Unless you were like Watts.
Yeah, Watts and Ole were like the only two.
But this isn't acknowledging them on TV or anything. This is just maneuvering behind the scenes. Yeah.
Now this is more important. If you had to pay a ticket to either of those shows, because neither one of them looks like great shakes. Which one would you pick?
Oh, you got Flair and Dusty in Florida. Yeah, that's where you go.
And rock and roll.
You know what? I'm going to disagree with both of you.
I know. I wasn't answering the affirmative yet. I was trying. I'm weighing it. Oh, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm going with WWF for those two top matches. Tito and Orndorff. Orndorff could roll at that time, man. You know, and Tito was one of the best wrestlers around at the time. And Andre was still young enough to move around, and Roddy Piper was pretty great. So I think that Ric Flair and Dusty always end up disappointing me in the ring. You know, very few of their matches ever like really appeal to me from a work standpoint. I kind of like more like the drama and the results than I do the actual matches. And there is nothing on that card, even the rock and roll, unless I even worked a handicap match. I do not want to see Nikita Koloff in 1984, and nothing else on that Florida card appeals to me as much as those two top WWF matches, which are guys who typically don't pair up against each other, which I think would be a unique experience.
Well, the thing about Florida, though, is Florida, you look at this lineup, the Florida, and the decline is starting, but there's still some pretty good names on there. Now, you would get that time a year later. And
I mean, do you really want to see Jesse Barr and Dory Funk versus Billy Jack and Mike Graham? Ugh.
Scott McGee versus Dick Slater's good, though.
That could be okay.
And Paz and Kevin Sullivan, it depends on how it's worked. And One Man Gang's Babyface here, which was always interesting to me, that run as Babyface in Florida. Because Babyface One Man Gang was pretty effective, actually.
Yeah. No, I get that. I figure, you know, Moondogs versus Jobbers.
Yeah, the fact there's a lot of job matches on the show, that kind of turns me off.
Well, and it's job guys that I didn't even realize.
Right, Moondogs are fucking rowdy, man. I love them beating up on Jobbers.
Well, it's WWF Moondogs.
Still, my man Larry Latham.
What's amazing about the job guys on this show, though, is that they're job guys that most of them are job guys that I didn't even realize would work house shows. Like, it's one thing to have your Johnny Rods, Rene Goulet, SD Jones, etc. But you have Joe Mascara, Joe Murto?
Right.
I mean,
Joe Murto worked all the Florida shows.
Well, I was going to say Rusty Brooks and Aldo Marino were local guys, so that at least makes sense. But, I mean, still, though, I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Those are guys that were just those were straight up TV jobbers. Those were not preliminary wrestlers that lost on TV.
Exactly.
And that's so deep into the card, though, too, because then, like, that's what's kind of amazing about it.
Well,
like,
what you're trying to do there is sell the show on Andre and Piper, who were both red hot at the time.
What else were they running that night?
Where else?
Yeah, with, and with who? Let me see if I can find.
They would have been in Northeast, but you know, do you look at the, you know, the Battle of Miami? More often than not, the CWF won most of those battles. It became like a battle in vain for Vince at one point.
Kind of like trying to run Texas or invade Dallas.
They ran the Garden that night, Bix. We just talked about it.
Oh, that's right. Okay, I didn't realize it was the same night. I didn't think about
it. We'll talk about that again when we get to that segment. But yeah, so that was why the crew was so, you know, bottom feeder heavy in some of the matches.
And then the next night they ran Toronto with.
Yeah.
Was that the same crew? Was that the same crew as New York?
They had some of the mixture.
Yeah.
All right. But, you know, like I said, Florida's on the downward spiral. Now we're going to a promotion that's on the upward spiral and been mostly going up all year long, and that's Mid-South. And they had TV tapings on September 26th. And, you know, it wasn't a lot going on at that taping, but because the next one would have a lot of news. You know, Ted DiBiase would return, blah, blah, blah. But we do have this. Adrian Street, the exotic one, defeats Terry Taylor to win the Mid-South television title via a kiss on the mouth, which appalled Jim Ross. I mean, it was like somebody may have, you know, shot somebody or cut somebody's arm off. He was, he was so sickened by a man kissing another man.
Times have changed.
And this was a big deal because Terry Taylor was really pushed at this time, and he's actually about to leave the territory and go back to Memphis for a little bit. But I mean, this was a great way of getting Adrian Street over, Will. I mean, we saw Adrian Street Mid-South. He didn't last very long there, but his run was really great.
It was fun. It was fun. Adrian Street's a guy, I don't know, have y'all ever read his autobiographies?
I've never read one before.
I really need to.
They are super fun, man. I mean, talks about growing up as like a kid whose dad was in World War II, working the coal mines or whatever it was there in Wales. Kind of the bodybuilding scene in Great Britain in the late 50s, early 60s, early wrestling. I mean, you know, there's some stuff where he tries to protect kayfabe and, you know, I had to hit a guy with my patented drop kick to keep him down type stuff. But the stories are great. Man, I think he's released like 4 or 5 books. They're all like long books too. And they're all entertaining. His travels to Africa in the 70s filming some movie, some caveman movie. Just really super fun books to read. And so like I'm a fan of Adrian Street, the character. In the ring, man, I'd really like to see some of that earlier stuff from England, you know. But again, another promotion that just, you know, has a bunch of stuff just lost to history.
Yeah, I mean, his original British career was all before they started, or whether it was saving the recordings or doing it on videotape or whatever, right? I mean, the only stuff from England we have is like the one time he went back, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, but you look at how they portrayed Street. I mean, they did a tremendous job, and that's Bill Dundee at work there, because they, you know, he worked with Adrian in Memphis.
Had Street already done the music videos and everything before?
Yes, he did that in South. Okay. He did that in Southwest, which he was there. He was there before Mid South, and in fact, he did that. He was in Southwest before he went to Crockett, and they used him in Crockett when he was there. I mean, you got the Adrian Street, you know, and from 83, 84, he had went to Memphis, Florida, got over big in Florida, was a main eventer in Florida, in fact.
Dusty loved him.
Dusty loved Adrian Street. Went back, went to Southwest, then went to, did some shots of Florida again, went to Crockett, went back to Southwest, then went to Mid-South, then went to, back to Memphis. I mean, he was traveling all over, went to the Southeastern and Continental. I mean, Adrian Street, you know, of course, he started homesteading there after that. But, yeah, he was a big player wherever he went in that era, and that gimmick got over really good because he was so great in his role. He could really sell it. And he wasn't – I wouldn't say he was, like, over the top, although he was.
But that was the idea.
But when Miss Linda – it gave – the way he portrayed it, though – you knew he was a tough guy, and they pushed it.
Right.
They said, you know, Jim Ross and Bill Walsh talk about how tough Adrian Street was, how he had cauliflower ears. And even though he's playing this character, he's really a tough bastard.
Well, Mid-South was the best, and with Watts and Ross on the commentary, was the best at putting over the idea that this was a tough guy playing mind games.
Yes. So,
and he lives up to that persona in his books as well, as like a tough guy. He like punches guys in the face, never backs down. Almost like it's funny because he's so short, right? Like the guy has to be like what, 5'6", 5'7"?
Oh, yeah. I'd say less.
You know, yeah, if that, right? And he really plays up that little man complex a lot, you know.
Well, somebody, I forget who it was, I saw on Facebook last week. I posted a picture of Adrian Street that he took of that week. And Adrian has battled cancer. He's 74 years old, but it was a picture of him and Miss Linda on a beach. And Adrian's wearing a Speedo. And that motherfucker is so jacked. I mean, his body is insane for somebody his age. I mean, God bless him. And he looks phenomenal. So, and he's bald headed, so he's not, you know, classic Adrian Street with the blonde hair and the tails. I mean, he looks awesome. And we talked about Southwest. We're going to go to Southwest. And this is a promotion that's in a deep decline at this time period, as they don't have English language television.
It's still a lot better than it would become, though. I mean, they, in 85, things got bleak.
Yeah, this is like
Hold on. Just for the people out there, Adrian Street has his own website. It's called Bizarre Bazaar. And it's B-I-Z-A-R-E. B-A-Z-Z-A-R. And you're going to have to rewind this a couple of times to do that, because I'm not going to repeat it.
Bizarre is in weird, and then bizarre is in market.
Yeah, but I think they fucked up the spelling.
Yeah, anyway, I think you might be right from whatever
call. But either way, the point is, there's a picture of him and Miss Linda standing next to The Undertaker, The Big Show, and Vince McMahon, and he looks like a fucking midget. I know he's not a midget. But he looks like a fucking midget next to these monsters. Like, I would probably at least stand up to, like, Undertaker's, like, I would say up to his shoulder, you know? This guy is literally at Big Show's elbow. That's where he's at.
I think if Adrian Street had been taller.
And he's taller than Linda.
I was saying, if he would have been taller, he would have got a job with Vince.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, age might have been a factor, too, though.
Maybe,
he still looked great up until his 50s. I mean,
yeah, they would have pushed him, but again, he was too short.
Okay, and as for the spelling, yeah, Will's right. I think they actually tried to stylize it, because it's B-I-Z-A-R-E, B-A-Z-Z-A-R. Both versions are misspelled.
Right.
Somebody else may have had the original spelling or something like that. But anyway.
They still make and sell gear, although, don't they have kind of a bad reputation with that, though?
Well, I don't know. I feel like
I've heard of people who bought gear that don't quote me on that. But I feel like I've heard of people that
I'm
look at Bix trying to ruin Adrian Street's credibility, man.
I'm not speculating on none of that.
I get all my gear from K&H.
Going to Southwest on the September 22nd TV show, Jonathan Boyd, one of our favorites, claims that promoter Joe Blanchard was paying Voodoo Malumba, who of course is another one of our favorites, Big Red Reese, to lose on purpose as long as Boyd had him under contract, which prompted Dave to ask, what's next? Dave Meltzer, are they going to say that Manny Fernandez uses blades to cut his forehead?
That's not the same thing, though.
I just love that line from Dave. But anyway, I mean, and more Southwest. Southwest has said that their steel cage cat fight matches between Susan Green and Evelyn Stevens have been bombing at the box office. And they are blaming Green for not having a big enough chest is the reason for that happening. And they have brought in Princess Jasmine, who had a bigger chest. Dave mentions that most of the fans in Texas are kids and women these days, so they are marketing to the wrong crowd. And real quick, we'll tie this up with a bow before we talk about it. Kyoto Tim Brooks defeats Manny Fernandez in a Loser Leaves Town steel cage match in San Antonio at the Hemisphere Arena on September 23rd. And this was to get Manny Fernandez into Crockett Promotions, where his career would really go upward. But, yeah, Southwest, man, that was a wacky territory, Will. We've seen that, you know, watching stuff in the 80s set. I mean, they would do all kinds of crap.
Well, I think they were just throwing shit at the wall, you know, really. I mean, you know, because I was in San Antonio at the time, and I have buddies of mine, good friends that watched Southwest as a kid, but I don't even recall ever watching it on TV. However, when I was a kid, the promotion to watch was world class. You know, I mean, it was all about the Von Erichs.
And they were running San Antonio too.
Yeah, it was all about the Von Erichs when I was a kid. The Southwest, except when I got older and people found out I was a wrestling fan, they would talk about going to the Hemisphere and seeing like Bob Sweetan, Mr. Pile Driver, and, you know, guys like that. But man, everybody knew who the Von Erichs were. Even my wife knows who the Von Erichs are, and she despises wrestling.
They were out drawing Southwest in San Antonio.
And they were, and like Dave said, this world class was going for a totally different audience.
Right.
Kids and women and stuff like that. They were appealing to teenagers. Southwest was a blood and guts promotion that mainly appealed from, you know, watching what we watched, and maybe because they had that non-English speaking television there, they mainly appealed towards the Hispanic population.
Now, that's true. Most of my friends are Hispanic, so that's
fine. Yeah.
Do they have English TV anywhere, like in Texas still? Or, I mean, because Steve Stack was still part of
that. Yeah, there. Yeah, Steve Stack was there, but what we have from this era is mainly Spanish.
Well, and they have two language tracks, right?
Yeah. They had two announcers there together.
Sitting right next to each other and bleeding into each other.
and doing promos besides each other.
That's insane.
Which was always weird to watch on Southwest.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. And San Antonio, it's interesting because now San Antonio is like one of WWF's hottest cities. You know, it's like always ranked when Dave puts out like those rankings. It's always like in the top 10.
And San Antonio had been killed dead pretty much the next year by the infamous story about Bruiser Brody and Mark Lewin, where they went like 3 minutes in the main event or something like that.
I thought it was that they had a long match
or something.
They went like 50 minutes.
It was something, and it killed the town. And that's what right when they changed over to USA All-Star.
Well, I lived it, and the problem was, man, cable TV came on. And all of a sudden, we're seeing all of this other wrestling. You know what I mean? We're seeing WWF and rock and wrestling. We're watching.
And World Class couldn't draw anymore either. That's another thing.
Yeah, well, a lot of that, man, had to do with that stain of the Von Erichs. You know what I mean? David dying, and, you know. But then you had, you know, Crockett would come in 85. Now, be fair, Crockett never drew well in San Antonio. But it really showed you that, hey, man, you know, we're kind of getting the scrubs here in town. Even when All-Star Wrestling popped back up, you remember that? And they try and run San Antonio in South Texas.
Yeah.
You know, it was scrubs. Elton. You know, to be fair, I did get to meet Big Bubba. Not the...
Fred Ottman.
Uncle yeah. Fred. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, when did Luke and Butch leave Southwest?
Fred Ottman wasn't Big Bubba, was he?
Yes.
The same one who was in Memphis dancing along with Brickhouse Brown?
Yes.
Oh wow! I met him at the PX on one of our Air Force bases here.
Same guy, yeah. That was where he got his first big push.
Okay.
Well, no, he had been in Georgia's Siegfried.
He wasn't push.
I thought Siegfried did get a push.
He got jack shit. He got TV matches. That was it. Texas All Star was pretty damn fun promotion too, folks. For the short time it was around,
with Gary Hart hosting the TV.
Yeah, Bruce Brody driving around in an ambulance, but. Which would be, you know, repeated many times after the fact.
And he did in ICW too.
Yeah.
As a babyface, Gary Hart as a babyface.
Yeah. I mean, Southwest is just one of those weird, wacky, fun territories that just they tried all kinds of stuff, throwing us the wall.
Yeah. And I think I just missed the highlights. You know, I think the highlights of like 82 and.
Yeah, 82 and 83 was a golden run. When Bobby Jaggers dumped the shit on Scott Casey's head, that was the beginning of the end. They got him kicked off USA Network. And
well, no, not being able to pay got them kicked off USA.
Well, that was part of it, too, though. USA was pissed off about that angle. Very pissed off about that angle.
Well, yeah. And I think the 84 stuff's still pretty good, though. They still have some good talent. Boyd is great.
Yeah, that's the talent. Dude, that was just the beginning, though.
Yeah, and then 85 is grim, the little bit of it we've seen. Although they still have some good talent, and they bring in some interesting guys, like they brought in Pero Aguayo. And
yeah.
Who was it that Aguayo feuded with? I'm trying to remember.
Arandu?
Was it? No, was it someone else?
Arandu was there, and it was one of his main rivals.
Yeah. Okay. I'm trying to remember, though. There was someone else. There was another name, like big-name luchador, I think, that they brought in.
But anyway, we're going to World Class. We've talked about them. And they got some issues right now, but not in their state, as they are extremely upset with their TV outlet, KITN, in Minneapolis, Channel 29, who is preempting their programming on Saturdays for college football. The promotion had been plotting to start running shows in the Twin Cities before the year's over, but without stabilized television, they're having to hold off their plans. There are rumors going around that their tapes were getting mysteriously damaged, so they couldn't air. And there were also rumors that Vern Gagne had been recently making appearances at the station. Now, AWA used to be
That's like an episode of CSI, man.
Vern Gagne AWA used to be on KITN before they moved to WTCN. So that's where all those rumors came. He was being spotted at a TV station when he's on a rival channel.
But
so,
if they're already being preempted for football, then why? I don't know. That feels a little contradictory.
To show them at a later time.
Oh, so they were getting moved into a different time slot.
Yes.
And
yes.
Then their tapes are also being destroyed too.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Now, yeah, like I said, this is World Class going against the AWA. And that was one of the big talking points of this time period of Pro Wrestling USA, was that World Class refused to help out in that venture. And that was leading credence to the whole deal. Are they working with Vince McMahon or not? Now, Will, in retrospect, do you think that Fritz Von Erich should have made a deal with Vince McMahon and, you know, aligned with them?
I would say no. And let me explain why. Look what he did with Stu Hart and every other promoter. Promise them the world and then fuck them in the deal, right?
Yeah.
Yes, though Stu still got his percentage, though, on the local WWF shows. He did always get his percentage as local promoter.
Okay, but you understand what I'm saying. Vince never kept up his end of the bargain.
As far as paying him for the territory, no.
So I wouldn't trust Vince. I mean, Stu's problem was his talent was fucked up, including his sons, and they all died. You know what I mean?
You mean Fritz.
I'm sorry, Fritz Stu. I mean, it's so hard to tell them apart except for the Canadian accent, you know? I mean, but no, really. I mean, that was his problem, you know, is that his talent died and they were fucked up on drugs. That was Fritz's problem.
But you think, though, if that deal is made, does Vince put up with that stuff? Does he put up with them doing what they're doing?
He put up with it
a lot of guys. The question is like, I mean, but no, in WWF you didn't have guys showing up at bookings and you had guys missing bookings. You didn't have as many guys showing up wasted.
Exactly.
Right. But who knows? But I think Fritz had the infrastructure. I just think his talent crumbled on him, you know, and then the desk just left a bad stain on the promotion.
Now, the question for you, Biggs, is if World Class goes head-to-head with Vern in Minneapolis and in Twin Cities in that area, how do you think that plays out if they ever had done that?
One thing I do want to add on WWF thing first, though, I think maybe Vern, maybe if there was a more overt play or whatever that Vern would have taken it, because it's not like... I mean, his heart would really be out of wrestling after a couple more years for obvious reasons, but it's not like wrestling was his primary business anymore. As far as making money, real estate was.
Yeah. Oh, really? I didn't know that.
So, if Vince made like a really like, because some of this, I mean, is conjecture. I don't think Vince made like, did Vince ever really make a play like, hey, just let me buy you out and I'll be your local promoter? I don't think he did, right?
I think what Vince and you'll be my local do promoter. Was, you know, use them as they would still be World Class, but he would have access to their talent.
Well, because he loved World Class, he loved the TV show and everything too.
Yes, Like he wanted the Von Erichs to work the garden and stuff like that. Use their talent on big shows.
Well, and he wanted the production too.
Yeah, and he wanted their production people.
But I mean, with Vern, like, if Vince really tried to make a deal, I think maybe not Vern, Fritz would have been kind of for it because of that, though, if his sons were taken care of. So as far as Minneapolis, AWA was vulnerable, but I mean, WWF had the right, you know, people there, so I think it's tricky then, because I don't know if that's the right city to make a move, because WWF is already strong there. I'm trying to think, like, where else was the syndication at strongest? You know, Boston, we always hear about, Chicago to a point.
Texas.
Outside of Texas.
And mainly the Northeast and the upper Midwest.
So really Boston, Chicago, Milwaukee, Minneapolis.
Yeah.
So Israel, don't forget Israel.
Yeah, Israel.
I feel like Chicago's maybe a better play at that point because WWF had won Minneapolis so quickly.
Well, that may have been part of the whole deal too.
Well, yeah. But I think it's not, I don't know if it's the right territory to try to oust at that point because Vince had his eye on it so strong.
Exactly. It's a definite what if, and they would eventually work with AWA. You know, they sent Chris Adams and Kabuki to work a match on one of the AWA shows in Minneapolis, and of course, work with them on Super Clash. So, when Fritz made his decision not to go against in the NWA and Vern, they eventually coexisted. And now we're talking about the World Wrestling Federation and some interesting doings going on this week. As on the September 24th All-Star Wrestling / Maple Leaf Wrestling TV tapings in London, Ontario.
Only time they did that, by the way.
The only time they did it. Greg the Hammer Valentine defeated Tito Santana in 2 minutes and 52 seconds to win the WWF Intercontinental Heavyweight title. Valentine then destroyed Tito's leg afterwards, and he was stretchered out. This was taped to air on October 13th. Also on these tapings, Jack Reynolds made his debut as an announcer just 6 days after announcing on the inaugural Pro Wrestling USA tapings in Memphis. Now, Will, when we decided to do this show and I saw what happened this week, you were the first person that came to mind because of this match. Because I know that Greg Valentine and Tito Santana is one of your favorite feuds of all time. So the floor is yours.
Of all time. Look, if this we talked about this with Chikana and MS1, that you kind of wish that we had more matches on tape. Well, the reality is, people, with the advent of YouTube, with people coming out and finding or discovering or transferring old videos of MSG and Philly shows to tape, we have this feud, okay? And it goes over a year. And it starts out right when Valentine comes into the company, him and Tito start hooking up through matches. And in ring, this is one of the best feuds of all time. Barna might be the best in-ring feud in WWE history. I mean, what else would be in contention for best in-ring feud? Like, throw out some other contenders, guys.
Santana Savage, Savage Steamboat. I feel like I'm forgetting something else with Savage.
Maybe Punk Cena, right?
Yeah, as far as modern stuff, yeah, Punk Cena would definitely be up there. I feel like I'm forgetting something really obvious. I feel like I should say Savage Hogan, even though it's probably not
really.
Well, you
can't say Bret Shawn, because that's one of the biggest disappointments.
To a degree, Brainbusters Rockers, at least for its time. In terms of what else they were running.
I've seen those matches. This does not; those do not hold a candle.
Relative to what else they were running at the time, though?
No, I'm talking about all time.
So I would say the ones I already said. Then, so Tito Savage, Savage Steamboat,
and I don't think Tito Savage was as good as Tito Valentine.
Have you
Tito
seen that match from Toronto? Though, I mean, Tito Valentine's more consistent. Yeah.
Tito Valentine's one of the most underrated feuds of the decade, no doubt, no matter what. And it doesn't get talked about nearly enough, mainly because of Savage. You know, Tito, you know, and Savage having the matches they had, and of course, Savage Steamboat.
Well, what's great about Savage Steamboat's a pretty great feud. That's a good one to put up to it. But the great thing about this feud is, at first, it just starts off, you know, heel versus face, a little bit of cheating here, a little bit of this. But somewhere, whether it's the TV taping that happened this week, you know, where he lays waste to Tito, or whatever, it just turns violent. And I want to say that this TV taping is the catalyst. Because after this, Tito isn't trying to work holds and headlocks and shit. He's going straight up brawl. He's beating the shit out of Valentine. And Valentine has to use his wits and cunning to escape Tito's wrath. And that's what's really going on after that. It is really a nasty feud after this moment, leading to what I argue is maybe the greatest cage match in WWF history, which was the match where Tito won the Intercontinental title match from Valentine. And at the end, Valentine proceeds to destroy the Intercontinental title belt in disgust. But
great finish, too.
No, the finish was awesome. To me, I thought the match itself from beginning to end was awesome.
Now, have you seen the full version that showed up on Classics?
That's why I'm saying it. Because the clipped version, you don't get that vibe. But when you watch the full version and you soak it all in, especially after seeing how the feud just keeps going and going for over a year, I've always said, and we've mentioned this on other podcasts, how it's a tragedy that Tito versus Valentine wasn't one of the featured matches on the first WrestleMania. Because instead of just thinking of it as a historic moment, we might think of it as an all-time great card if that match was featured and got 20 minutes.
Right, they put Valentine into just this side title defense with JYD, and Tito just went over Buddy Rose.
And what was the stupid reason for it? They didn't want to hurt house shows by putting on a great match?
They didn't want to put a house show program on, yeah.
No,
because that was headlining house shows.
Something else. It was they didn't want to, like, ruin the program that was going on by featuring it on TV.
Well, wait. Think about it, though. Think about who was booking. Or who was at least officially the booker. George Scott.
Yeah.
So, of course, think about what he did 4 years later.
NWA. Yeah, same thing. On Clash of the Champions shows.
That's why the NWA is out of business. Sorry, just have to put that out
there. Well,
the NWA is in business. Just ask our friend Bruce Tharp.
You know what I mean.
Anyway, it was a tremendous feud, but, you know, Tito, you know, he went from feuding with Morocco to feuding with Valentine, and 1984 Don Morocco was pretty shitty. Yeah, so I know he had to be glad to be feuding with Valentine.
I thought 1980 Don Morocco sucked, too. I hate Don Morocco. I hate him more than any other not more than any other wrestler. Bruiser Brody's right up there. But Don Morocco is the shits. You hear that, Stephen Graham? Don Morocco sucks. He's horrible. He almost killed. Who did he almost kill with that body slam? Ted DiBiase. He should be banned from ever wrestling. He should be eliminated from the network, just like Hogan, Benoit, and all the other worthless assholes. Excuse me.
Now, this is a feud, though, and I think also Tito's reputation in general, though, is one that benefited from Classics on Demand.
Well, another thing about this feud, though, is both
no doubt.
Both men, this was, Tito, of course, would have the tag stuff, but this was like the end of Greg Valentine as a serious singles wrestler, push-wise.
Yeah. I mean, he did have the tag title push, though. After.
And Tito. Tito would become, he would go on the Savage, lose the title there, but this is it. This is their last runs, basically, as top singles guys in the promotion. So that's
a shame. That's a shame, too, because as we saw with Valentine Garvin, Valentine still had a lot left in the tank, man.
Well, hell, when they had their second house show run in 88, they had great matches.
Yeah.
I didn't even know they had a second house show run.
Tito and Valentine, I'm trying to think, they have the match from Los Angeles. Is Los Angeles the only one that's on tape?
Yes, on Z Channel.
So now I got to go find that.
Yeah, they just had great chemistry again. They would work together, like, I think they worked together on television, like, after the, like Rhythm and Blues version Valentine. I think they had a match that may have been on Primetime or something like that. I remember was fun. So yeah, they always had good chemistry together. Now, Bix, the thing about this that I want to get you to talk about is Jack Reynolds. And, you know, Pro Wrestling USA, the tapings happened like a few days before our week started. But it was taped in Memphis at Mid-South Coliseum. Lance Russell was the ring announcer, and Jack Reynolds was the announcer for television. And Vince made, I guess it was a smart move on Vince's part to go ahead and raid him out right before the TV show aired, because Pro Wrestling USA TV show aired, I think, on the 29th. That's when it debuted.
Well, they taped a lot of, and they taped a lot of shows too.
That and night. They taped a lot of shows. So you got Jack Reynolds appearing on both television shows. But talk about Jack Reynolds and talk about Pro Wrestling USA's the beginning.
So Jack Reynolds, now before Pro Wrestling USA, had he done anything in wrestling between IWA closing and Pro Wrestling USA?
If he did, it was very small time, but I don't know of anything.
So I guess, I mean, his association then was really, I guess, with Pedro Martinez and Eddie Einhorn, right?
Yes.
So he has the interesting distinction of being kind of the voice of these two sort of national, one's in opposition, one's, you know what I mean, but IWA, which is the first time someone tried to run nationally, and then to combat WWF, you've got pro going nationally, you got Pro Wrestling USA, and he had a great voice, was not an especially good announcer. I mean, he was kind of smooth. He was smooth, and I was going to say professional, but he was not great with guys' names, to say the least.
There was quite a few guys in that era was like that too. Bill Mercer,
Sam Menaker.
Talk about the TV.
Did he get the moves right? Did he get the moves right?
Because
Bill Mercer calling a pile driver a front slam or some shit.
Yeah,
sleep hold.
Yeah, but talk about the Pro Wrestling USA tapings.
So
weird that
was. Yeah, it was Mid-South Coliseum, and aside from the guys they were pushing as national names, like Lawler, and maybe who else was there from Memphis? I guess Tommy Rich.
Yeah, technically, yeah.
That they were pushing as, you know, stars. The Memphis guys were used as job guys, but it was current Memphis stars. So you have Eddie Gilbert, like the match that showed up on the Lawler DVD set with Eddie Gilbert is from the Pro Wrestling USA tapings, which is why Lawler just squashes him. Dirty White Boys, I remember.
The Nightmares.
Nightmares. Where was Savage that week? Why was he just not on the tapings at all?
Yeah, he didn't work it.
He was smart. and I mean, those Memphis guys were not happy either that that's how it played out. But
Jared got the trophy for promoters for being a great promoter. And he allowed his guys to get treated like dog shit.
And those shows that they were not good TV either.
No, they weren't.
I mean, it was just the lighting was terrible. It didn't even look like the Mid-South Coliseum, really.
No,
it
did not.
They lit it so badly.
Yeah, it looked. It didn't. It. You wouldn't even know it was the same building.
I mean, that when they shot the stuff for when they tried to do the ESPN pilot the following year, that looked much better than this taping.
Yeah, Pro Wrestling USA was DOA anyway.
Although, I mean, I like the stuff they did like with the second batch of shows where they started like
from Crockett.
Yeah, from at Crockett's tapings because you had
well,
hot
what
crowds.
Do you expect? Crockett crowds.
Right, you had Crockett's crowds, but with a different talent. So it's kind of interesting because you have like Lawler and Backlund in front of the Crockett crowds. I like those shows, but these were not good. And then eventually it just becomes an AWA show.
Well, I think the problem is that they didn't feature the wrestlers the way they could be featured. You know what I mean? They had these guys in 4-minute, 6-minute matches and not like...
Well, and they weren't really doing interviews or programs either.
Right, but what I'm saying is they didn't feature these guys to illustrate their strengths.
No.
Because if you look just from a talent stand-wise, it should have been fucking awesome.
Right.
Right? I mean, we should have been saying, wow, we're finally going to get to see all these dream matches instead of saying, wow, that kind of sucked.
Yeah, like I said, it was DOA from the start, and it was mainly a vehicle to push Bob Backlund and guys like that. You know, Eddie Einhorn was the guy behind it, which, you know, Bix just mentioned. And he was pushing the guys that he thought would be, you know, the guys that would draw. And, of course, it then became AWA before the year was over, pretty much all AWA guys. So, yeah, it was just a deal.
What date was that? Was the taping?
September 18th.
Oh, okay. That's not, for some reason, that's not on Jason Campbell's site. That's weird. So they did it that time. They did it the day after the regular Memphis House
show. Oh, you want results? Is that what you're wanting?
I was looking. I just wanted to look at some of the match. I just wanted to read off some of the matches. Yeah, I thought I remembered it being on here, and it's not.
Yeah, I mean, all right. Here's the results from the show.
You don't have to. How many matches? You don't have to read all.
Oh God! I mean, it's a load of them. There was like 20 matches.
Just give some examples for.
All right, Rock and
Roll Express. Give us some highlights
and some of the guys who and the non-Memphis guys who were there.
Rock and Roll Express over the Nightmares, and they only drew 3,000 people at Mid-South Coliseum too. So a terrible crowd.
But they drew almost 7,000 the night before.
Yeah. Bot Winkle over Lanny Poffo. That's an interesting match. Lawler and Rich over the Dirty White Boys. Rick Martel over Eddie Gilbert. The Fabs over Hickerson and Spoiler. Lawler and Rich over the Nightmares. Holiday Race over Dutch Mantel. The Fabs over the Nightmares. Dory over Dutch Mantel. Rick Martel over the Spoiler. That's Frank Morrell. Tony Atlas and Butch Reed over the Dirty White Boys. Jerry Lawler over Eddie Gilbert. Dory Funk Jr. Holly Race over Mark Reagan and Tracy Smothers. This is rookie Tracy Smothers. And the Rock and Roll Express over Phil Hickerson and Lanny Poffo. So, I mean, there was...
Sounds good on paper.
Road Warriors were there. Zabisco. Mr. Saito. Bob Athlin went on this show. So, I mean, it was... I think the reason why, because he was in Japan. But, I mean... They had something there, and just the other promoters couldn't work together no more. What a shock. What a shock, huh? That's wrestling, though. But anyway, back to WWF. And another announcing move, but this is a
much bigger deal than Jack Reynolds.
Much bigger than Jack Reynolds. Bruno Sammartino makes his return to the WWF after 3 years to join Vince McMahon back on the commentary team for Championship Wrestling on September 22nd. Aired on September 22nd, which was taped on September 11th in Poughkeepsie, New York. David Sammartino also made his debut on the show, beating Gentleman Jerry Valiant in 247 with Brutus Beefcake watching from ringside. This came as a result of Vince selling his lawsuit with Bruno over previous monies owed to him, as well as a contract for David. Bix, yeah, this was a big deal because Bruno brought, you know, that name is back. And he's back with Vince on commentary. And that's great and all. But David Sammartino, ooh, what a bust.
Yeah, doggone it, Chris. I mean, we talked about this 2 weeks ago. When did we talk about David Sammartino?
It's been a few weeks ago, yeah.
A few weeks ago with the whole steroids thing. We covered it then. I mean, just he was really not any good until he was older and looked like a different human being and that whole thing. When he was like early 90s, he started to finally kind of put it together, but he just, at that point, he kind of gave up wrestling for the most part. I mean, he did he had the one WCW match where he was pretty good, and that was it. I mean, it just didn't click for him. And I mean, you know, like we went over all, like it was even worse that at first he was Bruno Sammartino Jr. and then David Bruno Sammartino. Like, he should have had more time without any associating to Bruno, and they just made it too hard for him, and it didn't work for him. And when was when's the match with, who is it, Ron Shaw?
Oh, over a year later.
Okay, so I couldn't remember exactly when it was. That's why I knew it was 85 because WrestleMania.
Well over a year later.
Now, Beefcake at ringside, that's just Beefcake setting up his debut. This is not setting up the WrestleMania program, is it?
It's the beginning of the feud, yes.
I didn't realize it was that long a feud. Wow, so they feuded for like 7 months?
I mean, they planted the seeds there. I don't know if they when it actually started on the house show.
Wasn't he watching other people at ringside, though, at this point?
Yeah, but it was emphasized that he was watching David, though. But anyway, Will, Bruno as an announcer, I mean, Bruno's a legend in the Northeast. And, yeah, it definitely was a big deal to bring him back. But this time, WWF is trying to expand nationwide. Do you think that Bruno was... you know, the right guy to have in that role, or should they have gone with somebody that could have appealed more to, you know, the country, the rest of the country altogether? Or, I mean, what do you think about the movie?
Well, I just don't think he was very good because Bruno's kind of a marble mouth, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you need someone like a Jesse Ventura. You need someone outlandish like a Bobby Heenan, you know? I mean, to me, I think Bruno would be fine the same way that, who's the guy with the outlandish suits in Mid-South?
Boyd Pierce.
Boyd Pierce
is okay in Mid-South. You know what I mean?
Well, here's a question. Okay. Who do you, all right, here's who Bruno replaced, and let's see who you would take. Bruno Sammartino or Tony Garea?
Christ, I don't think I've ever heard Tony Garea talk.
All right, well, if you watch the early episodes of Primetime, not Primetime, TNT on WWE Network, Vince and Tony Garea announced some of the matches. And Tony Garea has that accent, yeah, but I thought he did a pretty good job in that role.
I think he did too. I thought he was fine. I mean, it was, and it was like he, and he just kind of fit well. You know what I mean? Like he fit in. I just don't even know if I can explain it, but he, I mean, he was a definitely a more skilled announcer than Bruno.
And Will, another story is,
I mean, I wouldn't argue with you guys. I'll take your word for it.
You know what? Also though, for someone who was as good of a promo as Bruno was, he was just, he didn't, I mean, I know some guys couldn't make the transition to commentary, but he just didn't even sound like a skilled orator. You know what I mean?
Bruno's one of these guys where when it comes time to talk for themselves, they're great. But when it comes time to put other people over, they're not effective in that role.
But I mean, it wasn't just that he was a bad announcer, just that he sounded like he could barely speak well.
Now here's this scenario, okay? Gene Okerlund was, you know, the original announcer with Vince, and he was taking off commentary. And the rumor was that Vince thought that Gene was overshadowing him.
Well, he was.
Gene was becoming a bigger star than he was. So they took Gene off commentary altogether.
Gene and Vince were really good together.
Yeah, they really were. I thought that they complimented each other real good, but Vince's ego got in the way. Do you think Gene should have stayed on as announcer doing matches, or do you think that he was great in his role as he was?
He did both, though. I mean, when he was doing commentary, he did the local promos, too.
Yeah, but they pretty much made him that guy, just that guy.
Yeah, I mean, I liked it. I mean, I liked him doing both. And I really liked the work he did around that time doing the local promos, too.
I mean, I think Gene would have done just as well as like someone like Lord Alfred Hayes. Some of the guys that they had were just kind of like that schlocky 1960s cadence. You know what I mean? And Gene sounded modern. He sounded, I mean, guy was a professional DJ, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So, I mean, Gene knew where it was at. I mean, Gene was great in his role, but, you know, he could have easily filled in. I think it would have been easy for him to take that role.
Plus, him being down on commentary meant that Chris and I didn't get his catchphrase anymore.
Which one is that?
Oh!
Gene is awesome on the AWA stuff. If you watch like the stuff from Winnipeg in the early 80s when he was a solo announcer, he was really great in that.
How could you forget that? Don't you remember watching when we watched all that WWF stuff, and then especially with him and Dick Graham calling the Philly shows?
Well, that was Cal Rudd.
No, he did a couple Philly shows, remember?
Yeah.
With Dick Graham. So he had Dick Graham doing his ooh and whatever. Yeah, Dick Graham was the beginning of every WWF announcer going ooh.
Yeah. But, yeah.
So they,
that's
so
right.
It's just back and forth between the ooh and the ugh.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah, I remember that now. But yeah, WWF commentary, it was all these random pairings going on in this era. And now they're finally getting a little bit of stability, you know, with Bruno and Vince back together again. And they thought they had some stability with Jack Reynolds and Angelo Mosca, but that didn't last long either. But
that's another. Trying to think who else was there. They brought in, why am I forgetting his name all of a sudden?
Roger Kent
for
he did St. Louis
a few weeks.
Yeah, he did the St. Louis shows with, I think, Lord Alfred Hayes, maybe.
And Mulligan.
Mulligan would come in after the fact, but yeah.
Well, Kent did the C show with Mulligan for a little while.
Yeah, but they did St. Louis too, Wrestling at the Chase.
That was the same show.
Yeah. And which we'll talk about that in a minute. We've had another debut on that show.
Well, because we're going to talk about that because I didn't realize that they did a taping at the actual Chase Park Hotel so late.
Yeah. All right, before we get to that, Terry Gordy has quit the World Wrestling Federation on September 22nd. Due to the feeling that the WWF aren't going to treat them right, and that Michael Hayes is chasing the pipe dream of becoming a big rock star. Buddy Roberts isn't too far behind, and Hayes is left teaming with Pat Patterson before he quits weeks later. The talk is that Giant Baba has gotten Gordy's ear, and he wants him to become a regular guy gym for All Japan, which, of course, what happens soon thereafter. But, yeah, Will, the Freebirds and WWF were just way miscast. You could definitely see there was a Michael Hayes vanity deal. It didn't last long, and it's just a
that they left was because they didn't know how to behave themselves.
No, actually, that was not part of this.
That was more Crockett than
that was Crockett. WWF. Yeah, that
no,
was
no. I thought that was the rumor that they were rebel rousers and that they kind of like
they were like that, but that wasn't WWF. That was Crockett.
That was always what I'd heard about WWF. But yeah. I mean, what are you going to do now? You have this Northeast company, right? That yeah. later cast Dick Slater as the rebel in a babyface role, right? I mean,
yeah.
you know, to me, if you can't do something right with the Freebirds, whether you're Vince
in 1984,
or whether you're Vince or whether you're Vern, because Vern didn't use them right either. You know what I mean?
No.
Then what's the point? What's the point? You know what I mean? You've done screwed up. You've screwed the pooch. Right, I mean, so I'm kind of the thought that this is completely on the company failing to realize what they had, you know, and that they instead of treating them as guys that have drawn everywhere they've been for the last 5 years or 4 years or whatever it's been, you know, you treat them with the proper respect and you find a way to make it happen. Michael Hayes was, you know, he was up to date on what was going on. I mean, he was doing the moonwalk and the Thriller dance and, you know what I mean? I mean, later on in the decade, he would become a parody of himself. But at this point, man, he was tuned into what was going on, man. And maybe he was just Southern. Maybe they were just too Southern.
And they were aligned with MTV, and so WF was. So, I mean, this is Hayes definitely thinking. He's hooked up with David Wolf, you know, Cyndi Lauper's guy. I mean, he's trying to get himself out there, and Gordy sees the writing on the wall. He knows what's going to happen.
Well, think of this. Who's the biggest drawing person in WWE history?
Hulk Hogan.
No. The redneck from Texas.
Oh, Austin.
Am I wrong? I mean,
I would think Hogan would be.
No, Hogan for longer, but Austin, wasn't that the thing? Hogan, you know, if you look at
Hogan
total.
Did more without,
put it this way, one of them made Vince McMahon a millionaire, the other one made him a billionaire. Okay? That's the way I look at it. Either way, we're arguing.
Well, he had to get to that millionaire first.
Either way, a couple of Southern boys made Vince McMahon a lot of money. And you're telling me Michael Hayes couldn't have done the same? I call bullshit on that one.
No, he wouldn't. I mean, I say Michael Hayes was trying to use it to get his music out there. It wasn't about the wrestling, I don't think, per se. It's Michael Hayes trying to propel himself into MTV.
At Street USA was a pretty great fucking, yeah. You know, now I don't know about this. What's this one? Let God Back Into the Classroom or whatever the hell.
Why can't the kids pray in school?
It's yeah, about the Second Amendment, you fucking idiot.
That's later on, Michael Hayes.
The Second Amendment?
First Amendment, man. I'm sorry.
But
you want me to tell you the clause?
The Second Amendment's a pretty well-known amendment. I don't know.
Yeah, now I'm the fucking idiot. God damn it.
No, but the Second Amendment has to do with Eddie Sharkey and Vern Gagne's office.
Yeah. Now, regarding Gordy and All Japan, Biggs.
I do know the court case, though. Do you want me to tell Michael Hayes the court case if he happens to be listening to us?
I don't think he's listening. But
Hold on. It was first, it was Engle versus Vital. Okay, and then – or Vitali. I don't know how do you pronounce it. I'm not Italian or whatever. And then it was Wallace versus Jaffrey. That's why your kids can't pray in school, motherfucker.
Gordy's going to All Japan. And Hayes went with him. And this has opened up a big lucrative second career for Gordy, you know, in the long run. But just definitely a smart move on his part.
And he fit there like a glove. I mean, he was perfect for All Japan.
And I think this, I don't know if this actually led to any heat with Gordy and Hayes, because if you remember, Gordy, when they came back, Gordy didn't go with Hayes. He went to Texas and worked world class. Well, Hayes went to Florida with Buddy. And Gordy wouldn't join up with them until after January, in January 85. So I'm always curious about this, if there was any like ill will between Hayes and Gordy because of Gordy quitting.
Some
like
this. Ill will?
Yeah. Ill will. That's right. Because, you know, you left Hayes team with Pat Patterson against the Moondogs on house shows, which is just a weird to look at. Weird result. And speaking of weird, Jack and Jerry Briscoe make their WWF debut defeating Dave Barbie, who was Andre the Giant's babysitter, and Rene Goulet in 3/16 on the September 28 TV tapings at the Chase Hotel, which aired on Wrestling at the Chase, and the October 7th airing of Georgia Championship Wrestling. Now, A, like Bix brought up, I didn't know they were taping at Chase Hotel this late until I read this. And B, the Briscoes had been aligned with WWF for a couple of months now and just now starting to wrestle for them. And then, and of course, Jack wouldn't last but a few months, and then Jerry would retire after the fact. But this is it's weird to see them in this promotion, Bix. This is real weird.
Yeah, I mean, they ended up having good matches.
With the North-South connection.
Yeah, but, I mean, they did seem kind of out of place. And, of course, Jack decided to retire when he discovered cold weather.
Yeah, because that was a Southern guy. You know, they worked in Southern territories most of his life.
Yeah, and...
And as NWA champion, the only far north, they went into Toronto and stuff like that, but... You know, they didn't go up north a whole lot.
Yeah, and I just feel like how would they have fit in otherwise? I mean, Vince gave him a big push. I'm looking at this. I mean, I'm looking at, as far as the Chase, though, like, I'm not, at least on Gramps' sites, there aren't any results. Did they run there at all between January and September?
I guess not, if Graham didn't have the results. I mean, they take from the Keel.
Right. Well, they kept the show on. They kept the name like till like 86, 87. But...
And they take from the Keel in 84 because that's the Tito Orndorff match.
The show was called Wrestling at the Chase, and that's why they're because they taped at the Keel Auditorium.
And Vince
doubled as the C show.
And Vince had what? And Vince would commentate in one of my favorite positions that he did. His table was between the rail in the corner of the railing. In the crowd, so he wasn't like in the center of the rail like on Monday Night Raw, how they are now. He was on a corner, so it was just off of the corner somewhere, whether it was him and Guerrilla or him and Gene or him announcing by himself. Those were always interesting shows because the Keel's a huge building, and they weren't taping television in huge buildings that time. They were Poughkeepsie and White Plains, New York, and places like that. And then you see this massive building, the Keel, and it was an interesting look. Now,
What was weird about it though was why were they reserving this? Like, two things: A, that they did these weird house show TV taping hybrids, where they do a house show, but they'd also tape TV squashes and stuff. And then also, like, why are you wasting these great looking Keel tapings on the C show?
Just for market specifics, I guess, would be the reason why.
Well, but no, but I mean, they aired that as the main show in St. Louis, but market everywhere specific. Else in the country, though, it was the... No, but I'm saying, why not make that your A show?
Well, who knows where else it aired?
It aired wherever they got the C show, which was Superstars, which became Spotlight.
Yeah, but who knows where that aired?
New York. Where did it air besides New York?
That's what I'm saying. In 1984, who knows where that would even air at? And they would show a lot of this stuff on the Georgia show, too.
Well, that, too. They showed it on Georgia. They showed it on All-American, eventually Primetime.
Yeah. So it got out there. Now,
stuff like that. Well, not Primetime, because they were done. You know what I mean.
Well, we talk about Michael Hayes and him being on the cutting edge of the scene in 1984. Well, in my opinion, nothing says cutting edge more than Jack and Jerry Briscoe in 1984. I mean, they stuck out as a sore thumb, didn't they?
Oh, no doubt, man. They, the problem is that, would they really stick out if you know, if you had guys like Murdoch there who could work with the Briscoes any day of the week, right? I mean,
yeah,
they proved that. The Murdoch and Adonis could have great matches with the Briscoes. But I think certain wrestlers should just stay in their wheelhouse. Dusty Rhodes should stay in the South. You know, Hulk Hogan should stay in the North or whatever. Does that make sense? Buddy Rose should stay in Portland forever.
Yeah. Sorry,
there was so much space there. I'm just saying. I mean, the Briscoes should have stayed where they were at. You know, you have success somewhere and you're beloved somewhere, and then you go somewhere and you're just another face. I think so many people went to New York and became just another face, and it hurts their kind of appeal.
Well, they were different though because they sold their promotion.
Right.
So they pretty much had nowhere else to work but there if they wanted to work. You know, right. That kind of tied their hands together in a way. So
why did they wait so long though? I mean, you alluded to
it earlier, but
they
weird.
I mean, the sale first went down in April, then yeah. It didn't get settled and then the show didn't get transferred till July. And here we are at the end of September where they're finally so had they been wrestling anywhere?
No. They had last worked Crockett
and then
I think June maybe was the last they worked in Crockett, and that's when the word got out.
Okay, right. That's what I was part of what I was wondering. Like they had managed to keep the sale secret.
Yeah, and then
even
that's
though what, which is weird because when did Ole take him to court?
I really don't know.
Because it was April, right? It went down in April.
Yeah. Yeah, it was in April. So we're on our last news bit here, and this is a cool little thing. Hulk Hogan appears as a guest DJ on MTV on September 25th and did an hour. And this was yet another part of the burgeoning relationship between MTV and WWF. I vaguely remember this. Of course, the bigger deal of Hogan would be Saturday Night Live the next year. But, I mean, that MTV-WWF deal was pretty damn important to WWF's business structure in this time period, Biggs. Wouldn't you say so?
Yeah. I mean, just demographically and just everything. I mean, it was... And it got them so much media because it helped them with the illusion that wrestling was just suddenly, you know, big and doing well. I mean, the thing, you know, there's a thing Dave always talks about, you know, in The Observer and on the podcast and stuff of how, like, they convinced the media that wrestling was just now suddenly selling out Madison Square Garden. Which, just think about that for a second.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and they would air the shows, you know, the Garden shows on there, you know. WF talent was always on MTV. Of course, you know, the war to sub the score. The
brawl ended all.
Well, you know, Vince did take wrestling out of the smoke filled.
He did. Oops. He did. And Will, you're a little bit older than me. MTV in 1984, that was like the year that it really caught on strong.
Shaped everything, man. Just shaped everything. That's when you started to see the discrepancy in what WWE was doing, and to a lesser extent, Texas. Because Texas had kind of state-of-the-art stuff, right?
Yeah.
And I'm in Texas. So to me, a guy wears a cowboy hat or a belt buckle or has a handlebar mustache, to me, you don't even blink. You know what I mean? I'm sure you felt the same way, Chris. But
yeah, sure in different ways, yeah.
But it's just a completely different atmosphere, completely different environment. Just you never view wrestling in the same way again.
Yeah, and like I say, MTV was, like I said, the VO Music Awards debuted that year. I mean, this is when MTV is becoming MTV, and WWF was right there with them. It's funny to watch how that happened. You know, WWF expanding, MTV expanding, same time period, and they're coexisting. And it was funny, though, it was... You know, after WrestleMania, that was it. Pretty much between WWF and MTV.
Yeah, what? I feel like I've heard the story as to why that was it, and I can't remember. But I can't remember. Like there was a story, right?
They may have got pissed. They went to NBC.
Hmm.
That may be part of it. I really don't know. To tell you the truth, I really don't know the story there.
I mean, because you would think there would have been more to it. That.
Yeah.
And I mean, eventually MTV, the years later, MTV started kind of celebrating it and referring it back to as like a pivotal moment in their existence.
Yeah.
Like, because
again, like, they re-aired War to Settle the Score, what was it, once, twice? Like, they did it at least once. They did this, made a big deal out of it for, what was it, the MTV 10th anniversary?
Yeah.
Is that what it was? Because I feel like that's around when I first saw it.
That would have been 91.
That sounds about right, doesn't it?
Yeah.
As to when it got re-aired?
Yeah.
It's weird. And now, well, so you said you remember this a little. Like, you know how sometimes we'll hear about people who say they saw Hogan beat the Iron Sheik on MTV?
Yeah, it didn't happen.
Okay, so did it not happen, or did they show clips?
Showed it. They showed it.
But they didn't
show over and over.
It wasn't telecast on MTV, but it was shown on MTV.
But they showed it enough that if someone's remembering, it's not like it's faulty memories that we're talking about.
No, they saw it on MTV.
Yeah.
Exactly. But on that note, we're going to get our plugs in.
Although I did want to briefly talk about it.
Get in with your plugs.
Why is that part of my plugs this week?
Well, just to get it, just talk about it. All right, Will, what's going on with the Dangerous Alliance podcast?
This week, we're going to have another episode out. Always have fun doing those things, man. Probably air on Wednesday here on Place to Be. Look for me and Phil doing a special digging in the crates episode where we talk about matches that appear on NWAClassics.com. And that'll be up after this show. So look for that. We had a blast just running down some of the best matches from that network and basically doing an hour and a half infomercial on why you should purchase NWA Classics.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the best things to come along the wrestling internet in a long time. That's really great service, and maybe one day they'll get on Roku. But right now, and you know, watch it on a computer, watch it or hook it up to your Apple TV or whatever you do. Yeah, definitely check it out. And we got reaction shows coming up too soon, so be on the lookout for that. Now, Bix.
Oh, we got how many do we have next week?
Chris, we got three. The Madison Square Garden show is next Saturday. Then NXT.
Hell in the Cell is next week too, isn't it?
No, Hell in the Cell is way away. It's the end of the month.
Hell in the Cell.
Yeah, we got another 4 weeks.
Oh shit! Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh okay. Yeah. Cool.
But yeah, we got reaction shows coming up, so always be on the watch out for them. And Digging in the Crates is a really fun show too. Phil Schneider, you know, has a different take on everything that other people don't have, including the way he does his podcast, and it's really fun and really different.
You know what? I don't care what Johnny Sorrow, that piece of motherfucking shit, says. I'm going to say it right now. Phil Schneider has exposed me to more great wrestling than any other person on earth. Without Schneider, there's so much wrestling I would have missed out on that I'd be really angry about missing out on.
Hey, yeah, you said it many times, so I mean, let's be true. Now, Bix, before you do your plugs, talk about the real quick of the newsletters of this era and the differences we had between, you know, we didn't have no Pro Wrestling Torch, and Dave was doing his biweekly. But talk about some of the other things that were going on.
How old would Wade have been at this point?
Who, Dave?
Wade.
Oh, Wade? Wade would have been in high school.
I don't know if he would have been in high school yet. Wasn't he in high school when he started the Torch?
Wade would have been 13.
Okay.
So, right there.
Yeah. So, we were trying to figure out what to do. We happened to have the Observer for this week, and we were looking at some of the other stuff, like from Jason Campbell's site, and the two, there were two that come to mind, which was... The big one, I guess, would be Steve Hellwagon's Eastern Wrestling News or International Wrestling News. It was either name, depending on when he released it. And which I guess would be, at least of the stuff we have, the closest in style to The Observer, right?
Yeah, and had stuff that didn't really get talked about in The Observer.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, it's always like that with the different newsletters. I mean, less as time went on, but... At this point, I mean, it's more spread out.
And the thing about Steve Hellwagon is Steve Hellwagon is really known for writing the Ric Flair results book.
Yes.
That everybody used.
About to say
but
that.
Now, Hellwagon is he's a big-time college football writer.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, well, I don't know if he's the guy in charge of it, but he's in charge of Bucknuts.com, which is Ohio State's. It covers Ohio State athletics. He writes for 24/7.
Did you say butt nuts?
Buck Nuts, not Butt Nuts.
Oh, okay.
Or Slap Nuts. But yeah, he writes for 247sports.com, covering the Big Ten. Yeah, he's big time. He's crossed over. But yeah, he did a really good job on these newsletters.
Yeah.
And like I said, it's a different era. And there's another guy too that had some really good stuff as well.
And that would be Joe Shedlock, who's, I think it was just called Wrestling, right? Or Wrestling 84 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And his was more of a clippings and results and a little bit of news type newsletter.
I mean, which the newsletters of the era, that's what they mainly were.
Well, it depends. Like, some of them were more clippings, like, why am I forgetting his name all of a sudden? Tom Burke. Tom Burke's Gold Wrestling News and Terry Justice a few years earlier with TNT Times. And others were very results heavy, and Joe Shedlock's was kind of a mix.
I like that, man. I like that mix of, like, old newspaper clippings, like, reading USA Today articles, you know?
Yeah, I love the clippings and stuff. Obviously, Chris is bigger on the results, but I love looking through this and Global Wrestling News Service and TNT Times and Combat Sports and all those just to look at the old newspaper articles and all sorts of stuff they put in there. So
yeah, it's cool era because wrestling would get covered in newspapers quite a bit.
Yep. And you know, and obviously, you're really not going to know this stuff unless you were getting the newsletters back then. You're not going to know this stuff from outside your own area.
Yeah.
So a lot of this stuff is going to be new to you. And there's all sorts of like stuff. Like sometimes it'll just be a clipping, you know, for a show. But a lot of times there'll be the wrestling column or a profile on a wrestler, you know, and just lots of cool stuff then. And hopefully we'll find more.
And another thing about them too is that, you know, this is before we really got inside news. I mean, that's why we didn't do a whole lot of inside news on this show because, I mean, the kayfabe was still protected very heavily at this time period, and Dave really didn't have the sources yet that he would have down the line. So this is a very different type of show than what we normally do, if you've noticed. So,
yeah, I mean, from the little bit I was reading, it seems almost like maybe even like Steve was a better source than Dave at the time.
Yeah, it does. It's very interesting. Now, go ahead and plug your shows, all 430 of them.
I don't have that many shows. I just
have stuff. I mean, I have shows, but
yeah. Hold on, wait. That's you plugging your shows, Chris.
Yeah,
I'm talking about jobs. Bix's jobs.
You're confusing me with Will and yourself. And
yeah,
so I like to call us the podcast whores. Wait, that's Dylan Hells. Never mind.
I'm a pimp, goddammit.
New Fighting Spirit magazine comes out this week. Officially Thursday. Usually it's midnight UK time, so that's like depending on what time of year. So that's either like midnight or that's midnight their time is like either like 7 or 8 o'clock Eastern, where it goes up online. And I have both finally my WBF World Bodybuilding Federation article, which I really like how it came out, although I heard they got some cool photos for it, although it was a little more difficult since they had to go through, you know, different people, but heard it looks really cool the way it got laid out and all that. And also have a profile of Bill Apter with his book coming out in, I guess it's about 2 weeks now, and that I really like how that came out too. So a bunch of stuff for me in Fighting Spirit. As always, Figure Four Weekly each week on WrestlingObserver.com, which just got its, I don't know what you'd call it, emergency redesign, because the Tony had been getting the redesign ready for a while, and something happened that made him need to rush it to getting it on the site, and people had issues. But I guess everything's cleared up now, so
It's finally getting there compared to what it was a few days ago when it was mass chaos.
Yes, and of course I got stuff each day on both SEScoops.com and MMAnews.com, and I'll be doing more stuff with Daily Dot, I'm sure, and I've got some other stuff coming soon that I can't quite talk about yet. But
would that be asking Meltzer to put Dean Rasmussen and Phil Schneider as Hall of Fame Observer voters? Just asking.
Yes, I just don't get paid for that.
Oh, okay, cool.
And yeah, that's all you need is more websites to write for. The Keith Olbermann, the professional wrestling.
On the Minoru Suzuki.
Working for
Keith Olbermann goes from place to place, like, and leaves like on bad terms. I'm the freelancer.
Yeah,
there you go. You're the Bruiser Brody of professional wrestling journalism.
No, that's bad. Don't compare me to Brody. Jesus.
All right.
Watch. Now you're going to get me murdered by Mike Johnson one day.
I did not compare you to Dory Funk Jr.
The Mil Mascaris of wrestling journalists.
I'm sucking in my gut as we do this.
Christ.
Well, that's your problem, I guess. I gotta get my plugs in because I got a lot going on right now. Of course, these shows drop every Monday, so always be on the lookout for that. Between the Sheets, Exile on Bad Street's on a roll right now. Got two
rolling.
Got two great shows talking about Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. One I did with Dylan, our buddy Dylan Hales, and Alan Forel about the Japanese candidates
for the rolling.
And one I did on Carlos Colon with Dylan again, and our buddy El Boricua, the mysterious El Boricua from Pro Wrestling Only. And
breaking news, he'll be on the Hell in the Cell reaction show.
That show is phenomenal. Boricua is just a gold mine that's finally getting tapped into, because Puerto Rico is a wrestling scene that just doesn't get nearly talked about enough. And I hope it opens up a lot of people's eyes on Carlos Colon and how he should be in the Hall of Fame. And it's the biggest misjustice that there is. It's a criminal misjustice. The fact that, you know, there's people in the Hall of Fame that have far more negative stigmas in wrestling than Carlos Colon is in there. But Carlos Colon, one of the main reasons he gets held out is because
family murderers.
He kept employing Invader. When Vince McMahon, as we found out lately, did far worse with Jimmy Snuka. So, come on now. Let's be serious here. Carlos Colon.
And the stories he gives, Chris, are classic. I had a chance to listen to that show before anybody because I edited the thing. And Boricua's stories about Abby, about Colon, about what he saw on a week-to-week basis from Puerto Rico. You can't get that kind of experience from any other person that would regularly listen to these shows. You just can't. I mean, Boricua is a one-of-a-kind.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that he's on my side and doing my shows. So it's phenomenal. And we'll have more Hall of Fame shows coming down the pipeline pretty soon.
Rolling.
So I'm going to try to crank them out as soon as I can. So, Will, be ready because they're coming your way. On that note, I'd like to thank Will for joining us on this show, and we'll definitely have Will back in the future. Bix,
like,
of course.
Like November would be ideal.
Well, we got a show in November, an Exile show that's already booked and ready. So, you know, we'll definitely have that coming. But, Bix, you're always there when I need you as my co-host, and I thank you.
I am.
And that's right. You bring the information. So
thank you for being a friend.
Awesome. So on that note,
you're a friend and a
confidant. And as Andrew Gold sings, we'll say so long from the Peach State of Georgia.
Sometimes you want to go wherever. Oh, man.
Oh, man.
I thought you were going to end with Roland.